introduce myself. I'm Cindy, and my surname is Chukunga. I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Police and a member of Parliament. Let me welcome the representative of a delegation from the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution, as well as the ISS, and of course the Department of Police, led by General Mgwenya. Probably we have not so far received any apologies. I'm not sure whether there are any. However, let me start by thanking or appreciating the two organizations that are here to make a presentation, SACAC and of course ISS, for accepting our invitation. And I want to believe that they also would have appreciated to be invited, but of course appreciating the fact that they made us aware that there is some work that they have done in this very important topic, which is corruption. And there's no way we're not going to try and find time to invite them to appear before the Portfolio Committee so that they can actually brief us. So they are coming here to brief the committee on the work that they are doing. We'll definitely ask questions. However, let me appreciate that. We also believe that it would be proper for us to invite the department so that they actually can comment on this very important topic as to whether there is some work that they are doing and if there is any, how far they are in as far as dealing with these matters. But I think it is proper for me to probably also start by saying that this past Thursday, the Minister of Police, Honorable Nathi Mthethwa, released the National Crime Statistics. Crucially, the statistics have highlighted areas where government interventions are strong and they are weak. And one of the areas where we should continue to demand faster and improved service is the aspect of crime against women and vulnerable groups in general. And as communities, I think we are also expected to play our role by ensuring that abusers are reported without fail and that all possible assistance is rendered to survivors of abuse. And I think I want to say something about the crimes that are called, in fact, crime that is called drunk and driving. Yes, it is a crime that is detected as a result of police action, and as such indicates that police are determined to arrest these criminals. At the same time, this means that more people continue to abuse alcohol and drugs and then get to car or their cars and drive. This is not just a crime that affects those drivers or even families of those drivers, but it also is responsible for many serious and fatal accidents on our road. And many people that are involved and actually continue to commit this crime are the very people who believe they are a responsible citizen, who will want us to believe that they are not criminals because probably on a particular day they drove drunk and did not cause any accident and were not caught, and therefore they're not criminals. I believe that it is time that as institutions, be it churches, be it schools, be it in our community gatherings, we condemn this practice. Drunken driving in South Africa is indeed a crime. In this regard, I want to congratulate the Department of Police for the work well done. I believe that such performance deserves to be commended. This crime statistic compares very well with other statistics released by organizations such as South African Insurance Crime Bureau, as well as SAPRIC. I just want to compare what South African Insurance Crime Bureau found and what SAP found. According to them, SAICP, the high-grade theft, the decrease is on average between 8% and 17%. According to SAP, the decrease is 11.3%, well within that range. The high-grade hijacking, according to them, the decrease is on average between 19% and 31%, and SAP it is 23.6%, which is well within that range again. Business robberies, according to them, the decrease is between 19% and 28%. And of course, according to SAP, it's an increase of 0.9% from a 4.4% increase and a 41.1% increase. It is therefore a decreased increase. According to them, business burglary, a decrease was between 5.5% and 19%, and according to SAP, it's a decrease of 5%. House robberies, according to them, they recorded a decrease of 4% to 21%, and SAP decrease is 10.1%. According to them, house burglaries, they recorded a decrease of 4% and 12.48%, and SAP recorded 4.8%. Well within the range of this independent, I want to believe, organization. But also, if you check on the SAPRIC statistics, also, not only have they recorded the decrease up to the end of the financial year, but they have recorded decrease up to, I think, June this year, which means even beyond that, probably for now, we are experiencing some gradual decrease in crime statistics, which I think we should appreciate. I'm just saying this as a way of saying to such the members of the police, but communities as well, and all those who play an important role, be they civil society organizations, we are appreciating the work that you are doing. However, today, we are about corruption. We think that corruption hampers our efforts to meet the basic needs. It destroys lives. It impacts negatively on economic activity, democratic practice, education, and the broader intellectual activity, as well as our efforts to progressively bring our communities closer to each other socially, economically, and spiritually. The fight against corruption is as such at the center of our national efforts to realize the goals of a better life for all. It is in this spirit that we decided that probably this portfolio committee, we need to have a discussion on this cancer, which we think it needs to be, cured. Having said that, I will just want to, as I've indicated, welcome the delegation, and we'll probably have presentations. I think it will assist because we do not have enough time to deal with this issue. So we're going to take presentations, three presentations. For now, we're supposed to have ISS, but I think they're still printing that document, and therefore we'll take a presentation from Kazakh, yes. And immediately after that, I think, as this document will be here, and then ISS will follow, and then lastly, it will be the department start to say. We've allocated 30 minutes for CASAC, and I think 40 minutes for, or maybe 45 minutes for ISS, and then we've allocated 30 minutes for or to the department. After that, we then discuss all the presentation and actually have an opportunity to ask questions. We will request members to jot down the questions relevant to each presentation. And thank you very much. Probably let me just give the general an opportunity to greet us, and then we'll go to CASAC.
A very good morning, Chair. I am Lieutenant General Mugwenya, the Chief Operations Officer within the Office of the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service. Together with me, we are a delegation of Chief 468, led by myself. I'm with Lieutenant General Mazibuko, in uniform on my right. He is the Divisional Commissioner of Personnel Management. Major General Mokhoff, next to General Mazibuko, he is the Head of Strategic Management. Major General Munipao, next to me, he is the Head Service Terminations and Behavior Management. Brigadier Mitchell, behind there, also from Strategic Management. Brigadier Menziwa, behind me, from Strategic Management, and lastly, Lieutenant Colonel Pillay, also from Strategic Management. Let me also take this opportunity and tender an apology on behalf of the National Commissioner, who could not make it due to other prior commitments. I thank you.
Madam Chair, firstly, thank you very, very much for affording us the opportunity of addressing the Portfolio Commission today on this very important topic of corruption and how we fight it. My name is Lawson Naidu. I'm the Executive Director of the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution, which is an NGO that was launched a year ago this week, so we will be celebrating our first birthday later this week. It's an organization that seeks to protect the fundamental values and principles of our constitution and to advance the notion of progressive constitutionalism and a constitutional democracy. We see the constitution as a means towards achieving the transformation of South African society, which is what we call progressive constitutionalism. And it's on this basis that issues of public accountability and indeed of corruption have come under our attention. We have recently released a report, copies of which are available here, that demonstrates the impact of corruption on governance and the realization of social economic rights, which you very correctly outlined in your introduction as well. CASAC earlier this year commissioned a study to look at corruption and mechanisms to fight corruption within the South African context. A report entitled Corruption Towards a Comprehensive Societal Response was therefore developed and was launched in March of this year. The title indicates the nature of how we looked at the issue, that it needs to be an all-encompassing approach to tackling corruption. The research aimed to identify key weaknesses in the legal framework, the constitutional framework, and the institutional framework that are already in existence. The report looks at our constitutional commitments, our international obligations, as well as the need for an effective framework to combat corruption. Interestingly, the report was released just a day or two before the Constitutional Court delivered its judgment in the matter. The elements of the CAPEX report certainly find resonance in some of the findings that were made by the Constitutional Court in that case. We start by looking at the constitutional framework. As the court in the Glenister matter declared, there's a responsibility on the state to respect, protect, and promote and fulfill the rights that are contained in the Bill of Rights. And it is this constitutional provision in Section 7, Subsection 2 of the Constitution that gives rise to the onus on the state to take action against corruption. Constitutional framework also includes the requirement to be accountable, responsive, and open, and that all public power should be exercised lawfully. These are concepts that are canvassed in Section 195 of the Constitution. Thirdly, the Constitution also provides for ethical conduct by those who exercise public power, either members of cabinet, deputy ministers, members of parliament, the judiciary, or public servants. Again, this is an issue that is covered in Section 96 of the Constitution. So it creates the constitutional framework under which issues of corruption need to be contextualized. We then also looked at a range of international agreements to which South Africa is a state party and which has ratified various conventions. They're up on the slide here. I don't need to go through them in any detail. I'm sure you're all familiar with those international agreements. What we then did was, having looked at the range of those international treaties, was to summarize the range of obligations on South Africa that flow from our having acceded and ratified those international conventions. And we have identified six issues. Firstly, that there is a need to establish an independent anti-corruption agency or agencies as provided in the UN Convention as well as the African Union Convention. Secondly, to ensure that steps are taken to investigate and, where appropriate, prosecute corrupt acts. Secondly, to prevent corruption by removing obvious opportunities for corruption. And thirdly, to educate the public on the harms of corruption and on the nature and scope of it as well. Thirdly, to ensure that there is transparency and access to information in the holistic fight against corruption. And therefore, issues of access to information are critically important, and also ensuring that there is easy access to information in the public domain. The obligations, fourthly, also include the obligation to establish mechanisms that encourage participation in the fight against corruption by the media, civil society, NGOs in general. And this speaks again to the title of the report that we issued, towards a comprehensive societal response. All of these stakeholders have a role to play in the fight against corruption. Fifthly, that we need to adopt measures that address corruption not only in the public sector, because there is, as we all know, a tendency to focus exclusively on the public sector without taking cognizance of the fact that corruption is as prevalent in the private sector as well as within civil society. And we need to tackle corruption in all of those sectors. Sixth and final obligation that is summarized in the report is the need to cooperate with other states, provide mutual legal assistance where required. Members of the committee will be familiar with the fact that corruption takes many forms, including cross-border and transnational crimes, and therefore international cooperation and mutual legal assistance are critical components in providing a holistic framework to tackle corruption. The report then discusses and looks at the range of organizations that already exist within the South African landscape to deal with corruption. There's the SAP, which includes the HAWC, the Special Investigating Unit, the Asset Forfeiture Unit, National Treasury, and in particular the Financial Intelligence Center, and the Chapter 9 institutions, the Offices of the Public Protector and the Auditor General. And there are a range of multi-agency report then identifies some problems that are inherent in that existing system. And three of the problems that it's identified and deals with it in some detail in the report itself is the fact that there is poor monitoring and enforcement with regards to anti-corruption legislation systems. That there's no entity that has a clear public education mandate. It's an aspect of anti-corruption activity that is absent from our discourse and absent from an institutional perspective. Thirdly, it points out that organizations that have a primary responsibility to combat corruption are not truly independent. This would be the case in the case of Hawks and the SRU and the AFU in particular, because they are responsible to the executive, which is a range of issues that has been traversed in the Glenister judgment. And that those organizations that are independent, such as that of the Auditor General and the Public Protector, do not have as their primary focus their fight against corruption. So that's the anomaly that is identified in that current institutional framework. If one then turns to the Glenister judgment itself, and I think I know the Portfolio Committee had a detailed presentation from General Dramat at a meeting last month. I'm not going to go over that in any detail. Safe to make a couple of points. Firstly, that there was a unanimous finding by all the judges that there is a constitutional obligation to take effective measures to fight corruption. The majority of the court found further that there was a duty on the state to create an independent anti-corruption system. If I quote from paragraph 196 of the majority judgment, where they say, the form and structure of the entity in question lie within the reasonable power of the state, provided only that whatever form and structure are chosen do indeed endow the entity in its operation with sufficient independence. The issue of independence is something that I will come back to later on in the presentation. So the issue of independence of an anti-corruption unit therefore becomes central to our discussion and our thinking around that issue. And the court made a few points in relation to independence. Firstly, that the structure of an anti-corruption agency needs to limit the possibility of abuse of the chain of command. Secondly, that it should protect against interference in the operational decisions about investigations and prosecutions and whether to terminate those in particular. Thirdly, that there should be structural and operational funding to protect the agency from undue political influence. The court also went further and talked about issues around perceptions of independence, and that the public perceptions and confidence in the entity is also an important component of how it is viewed as an independent agency, and that if there is no public confidence in the institution, that it undermines the perception of its independence. The judgment quoted from the OECD report, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which has done studies looking at various models for anti-corruption agencies around the world. And the judgment quotes from the OECD report, and I'll read out a particular section that deals with independence in particular, where they say, independence primarily means that the anti-corruption bodies should be shielded from undue political interference. To this end, genuine political will to fight corruption is a key prerequisite. Such political will must be embedded in a comprehensive anti-corruption strategy. The level of independence can vary according to specific needs and conditions. Experience suggests that it is the structural and operational autonomy that is important, along with a clear legal basis and mandate for a special body, department, or unit. This is particularly important for law enforcement bodies. Transparent procedures for appointment and removal of the director, together with proper human resources management and internal controls, are important elements prevent undue interference. End of quote from the OECD report. The CAPEC document then proposes that there should be a a dedicated independent agency with a three-pronged mandate of investigation and referral for prosecution, but the proposal suggests that the prosecution services must be separate from the investigating body and from the anti-corruption agency. Secondly, that it should have a mandate that includes prevention, what measures should be instituted to assist in the prevention of corruption and to minimize the opportunities for wrongful corrupt activities to take place. And thirdly, public education around corruption, which is an issue that I referred to earlier. The report drew on the experiences of the Independent Commission Against Corruption in Hong Kong, as well as the Directorate on Corruption and Economic Crime in Botswana. There are a range of models that are looked at in the OECD report that I've just referred to. This kind of an agency would be referred to as a multi-purpose agency because it has three-pronged mandate of investigation, prevention, and education. There are also purely preventative agencies, which are really focused on issues around research, managing and overseeing codes of conduct, asset registers, and so on. And then there are your traditional law enforcement agencies, of which, in our context, the Hawks would be an example. The issue around whichever model one chooses, and it is a point that is made in the CAPEC report, where we say that the single most important factor in sustaining an independent agency is the existence of political will and support for the agency. Even the most well-crafted institution will fail if the requisite political will does not exist. A dedicated independent agency therefore not a miraculous solution to the scourge of corruption. Indeed, this model does not find favor with some commentators in the corruption field, and it is not always considered the most effective possible response. The creation of a dedicated anti-corruption agency is not a panacea. In some countries that have implemented this model, they have proven to be ineffective. So we place before you the idea of a dedicated independent agency, acknowledging that it is not a panacea, it is not a one-size-fits-all model. We seem to have lost your monitors, but I'll continue for the moment. I think you have hard copies of the presentation in front of you, so we should be able to follow them. Thanks. So the issue of political will that is at the forefront of how we deal with it's an issue that echoed in the report, the diagnostic report of the National Planning Commission in the section on corruption, where they also refer to the existence of or the need to create a political will to fight corruption. One then moves on to the institutional design for this dedicated independent anti-corruption agency. There are a range of issues that one would need to look at in terms of how it is structured and put together. This is not a draft bill. It's purely a list of issues that would need to be encompassed in creating and establishing such a body. The first issue that would arise is the issue of location. And there are various options that may exist. That it could be a standalone body that sits as almost akin to a Chapter 9 institution, an institution protected within the Constitution as Chapter 9 institutions are. It could be an independent agency that resides within some arm of the executive, be it the presidency, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, or indeed the police. So the issue of the location is one that needs to be considered, bearing in mind the need for the agency to be sufficiently insulated from political influence, anti-political influence. One therefore also looks at the issues around functions of the agency, and I've covered the three-pronged mandate that we believe that the agency ought to be imbued with. Issues of accountability and reporting, because independence must not undermine the fact that the agency will need to be properly accountable for its work. staff, for example. There are five citizens committees that provide advice, and one of the activities of that is the commission. One committee advises the commissioner on policy, another advises it on corruption prevention, third one on education, and a fourth one on public complaint against the commission itself. There's a fifth citizens committee that also reviews all decisions to terminate an investigation to ensure that it is terminated for legitimate reasons, not because of undue influence and so on. It is also suggested that Parliament has a significant role to play in the oversight of an independent agency, and a parliamentary oversight committee would indeed give be very valuable in ensuring the accountability of the agency, and it would need to do so not simply on the basis of receiving annual reports from such an agency, but receiving far more regular reports so that it is kept abreast of development and is able to hold that agency to account. It is suggested that the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, SCOPA, could be given a specific mandate to deal with it, but it's an issue that is open for Parliament to determine how to exercise parliamentary oversight over an independent anti-corruption agency. There are issues of individual and institutional independence that have been traversed, and I know in the Glenister judgment and issues which you discussed at your previous meeting, one of the aspects that was highlighted and stressed in the judgment of the court was the issue of tenure of members of the anti-corruption agency, that a fixed-term contract, a non-renewable fixed-term contract settled for the head of the agency is a key component of the institutional independence of that agency, that it needs to have responsibility for preparing its own budget and for its internal functions including appointment and removal procedures for other staff. With regards to the head of the agency, it is proposed that an independent appointment body that would comprise the three arms of government, the executive, the legislature, as well as the judiciary, perhaps with civil society involvement in that appointment panel to ensure the independence of the head of the agency, and that the removal of the head of the agency should be akin to the process for removing a High Court judge. So it needs to be fairly well set out, and one can only say the head of an independent anti-corruption agency is a very exceptional and pressing circumstance. That the head of the agency and the internal the senior management of the agency should be responsible for recruiting and appointing all other staff, and for developing the internal structure of that agency, for preparing its budget, as I said, and to ensure that it accounts to Parliament and to SCOPA and to the Auditor General appropriately for the expenditure of public resources that is undertaken by the agency. In terms of its powers and responsibilities, an independent anti-corruption agency would need to be vested with powers of search and seizure, powers of arrest, interception of communications, access to financial records, etc. These are aspects of the powers and responsibilities of anti-corruption agencies globally, varying from agency to agency, and we would need to consider the range of powers and responsibilities that we vest in that independent anti-corruption agency. Another aspect that this committee will need to consider as to implement the judgment of the Constitutional Court in the Glenister matter is the issue of the relationship with other existing anti-corruption institutions and how to manage those relationships and the issues of cooperation and coordination, and whether that other organizations should be expanded, that their functions brought under the umbrella of the single agency, or whether some other mechanism can be worked out in which there is a coordinated level of activity. Some suggestions that you would need to consider in the context of the mode of operation of such an independent anti-corruption agency would be: should it investigate all complaints that it receives in order to eliminate the perception of bias, or should it only investigate some complaints? criteria that are in place in order to determine which complaints get investigated and which not, and what is the specific mechanism that is in place? How transparent is it, and how much public confidence is in such a process? So that's a critical issue to contemplate as we start to craft such an anti-corruption agency. Should the agency be able to institute its own investigation, only act on referrals and matters that are brought to its attention? Again, there are different models, and it's a question, again, that I posed for consideration by the committee. I said earlier that the model that we proposed, dedicated agency, would not include the duty of prosecution that would continue to reside within the National Prosecuting Authority, but that obviously there would be a need to cooperate and work closely with prosecutors in many of the cases of investigation of corrupt activity. And those are a working relationship that would need to be defined and worked out. One issue with regard to prosecution is it is being suggested that the sole criterion for prosecution in corruption cases should be the sufficiency of evidence in a particular case, and that the interest of public policy and discretion that currently exists with the National Director of Public Prosecution should not apply in the case of for prosecution for corruption, because it is argued that it is always in the public interest for acts of corruption to be prosecuted, and that therefore the only issue should be the sufficiency of evidence. In terms of preventing corruption, the responsibilities of the agency would be to promote ethics in public and private sectors, to develop and enhance codes of conduct to ensure that there are no conflicts of interest, set frameworks and guidelines for monitoring and enforcement of asset registers, to ensure that there's adequate access to information, and also that there is adequate transparency in relation to the funding of political parties. This is a particular requirement that is placed on us as a result of the African Union Convention Against Corruption, which implores all state parties to that convention to implement legislation to provide for the regulation and transparency of party funding, and to ensure that the proceeds of corrupt activities do not find their way into the funding of political parties or candidates. In terms of the prevention of corruption, the commission, the agency would also need to look at how to tighten up tender procedures, to look at issues around anti-competitive behavior in the private and corporate world, and also issues around insider trading, being the areas of private sector corruption that often go sufficient solutions. With regards to the public education mandate, again, this is very neatly encapsulated in the African Union Convention in Article 5, subparagraph 8, where it says that the state party should adopt and strengthen mechanisms for promoting the education of populations to respect the public good and public interest and awareness of the fight against corruption and related offences, including school educational programs and sensitization of the media and the promotion of an enabling environment for the respect of ethics. This was an issue to which the Deputy President in a speech a few weeks ago paid sufficient due attention to, and said that we need to start to inculcate values, education respective values and ethics, even from the level of school. The report also looks at other challenges in the existing legal framework, and I'm going to just mention these for your noting. Firstly, that there is inadequate protection for whistleblowers within the current legal framework. That there is there's been a failure to implement a cooling off period for politicians and public servants leaving the public service and going into the private sector. That there's been a failure to ensure that codes of conduct ensuring disclosure of assets are implemented and enforced. That there is, as I said, an absence of any regulation of past political funding. And finally, that the rules of criminal procedure often permit accused persons to delay or circumvent the criminal process in its entirety. These are aspects that you may wish to consider to incorporate in any legislation that you process in terms of creating an anti-corruption agency. In conclusion, Madam Chair, Whether the judgment has created a timely window of opportunity for us to consider the most effective mechanism to fight corruption. And I think we need to look at the matter in a holistic way. It provides us with the opportunity to rethink how we approach the issue of corruption, and not merely to tinker with the legislation that has been existing and has been found to be constitutionally wanting in the Glenister case. But we need to, Parliament should facilitate national dialogue. At CASAC, we have already discussed that document that sits before you with a range of civil society bodies, the South African Council of Churches, the business community, businesses in South Africa, the sports bodies, SASCOP, the major trade union federations, COSATU, NAPTU, and FEDUSA. And we believe that this is the time for a broad conversation, a national conversation about corruption, and that Parliament has a responsibility, I think, to facilitate the national dialogue on this, to hear the views of civil society, and it is in that regard that we are very grateful to have been given the opportunity to make this presentation to you in your meeting today. We certainly hope that this is going to be the start of a process of dialogue and interaction, not just with us, but with a range of other civil society stakeholders that have ideas and have done a significant amount of work on anti-corruption strategies and enforcement mechanisms. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to present to the Portfolio Committee. As you probably know, the Institute for Security Study is an African research policy development organization. We work towards a stable and peaceful Africa characterized by sustainable development, human rights, the rule of law, democracy, and collaborative security. I am Gareth Newham, and I head up the Crime and Justice Program based in Pretoria. And we work to do research and policy development and public awareness around crime, crime prevention, and functioning of criminal justice in South Africa. And it's a great privilege for us to be able to present some findings from a research project that's actually been going on for about 3 years at the Institute of Security Studies, looking at the nature of police corruption and what can be done about it. So I will be presenting the first part of my presentation will be a report that we recently released a couple of weeks ago. I've emailed copies of the report to you, but you can make hard copies available. I'll leave these with you. Really to summarize some of the kind of research findings around police corruption, this talks about what the police have been doing about corruption in South Africa. It locates police corruption in a global context, to make us realize that it's actually an occupation hazard policing worldwide. It's not a particular problem facing South Africa. And finally, a few areas that we think where priority focus should be given. And then the second part of my presentation will really be about what we're trying to do to work with to assist in tackling the issue. We've recently launched a Promote Professional Policing campaign, and that really aimed at educating and motivating the public to both recognize and reward good policing, so when they get good service from police officials, to make sure that they say thank you and talk about that, so that those men and women in police uniforms that are doing their best are actually supported and motivated to carry on doing that. On the one hand, on the other hand, also when they do come across bad policing, obviously, you can also report that to the relevant authorities, and we've shown how to do that, but I'll go into that in detail. Okay, so that's the nature of the presentation briefly. I think we're looking at what is police corruption. The international literature really very simply describes it as a misuse of police authority for personal group gain. Essentially, a police official uses their state authority as a police, man or woman, with certain powers, and they don't use that for the policing objectives, but they use it to make money for themselves, or for their own personal gain in some way or another. In South Africa, we have the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 2004 that provides quite an extensive legal definition of corruption, which also covers elements of police corruption, but I won't go into that now. I think it's very important to kind of realize why it's an occupational hazard worldwide, the challenge of police corruption. An analyst called Robert Pipcock in 1988 came up with a very simple definition where he said, corruption occurs where you have monopoly over some kind of power, the discretion to exercise that power, and reduced level of accountability for when and how you exercise that discretion. And that's how you define corruption across the public and private sector. So that's sort of a simple equation to look at where you might have corruption problems and how to address it. And of course, the police are uniquely positioned within the public service to deploy force and restrict civilian rights, because police officials have quite a range of powers behind them. They're trained, they've got a lot of access to places and information that ordinary citizens and other members of the public service don't have, their weapons. And often, when you look at the way policing is structured internationally, the least experienced and often the newest police officials are the ones out in the streets acting with a little supervision. Most experienced police, senior officers are in offices. So the direct line or direct supervision of a lot of what police do in the public area or out in the streets is not always direct. So sometimes you have to wait for a complaint to happen before you know that a police official has actually done something wrong. And decades of international research on police corruption found that it's a fundamental occupational hazard of policing in all countries. So it's no longer a situation of saying, does a police agency have any corruption? It's about what is the extent of the problem. I remember a very interesting seminar I was presenting at around 2000 with the head of the Scotland Yard Anti-Corruption Agency. And he said for years the chief of Scotland Yard had said they have no corruption. They're the cleanest police agency in the world. And one day they started realizing that their ability to raid targets of organized crime syndicates that are moving contrabands out of the UK across the continent of Europe, they started to see that when they raided these warehouses, there was nothing there. And they then decided to look into the issue, was there corruption? They put a few key intelligence officials into some of these units. And within a year, they identified 36 senior Scotland Yard detectives working with organized crime syndicates across Europe. So that was an organization that prided itself as being a particularly keen organization. It takes many forms and changes over time. We've seen in New York, for instance, how corruption in the 1970s called petty opportunity corruption changed to quite what's called meat eating, organized, where groups of police officials would work together to shake down on illegal gambling and alcohol use, and then actually get involved in some organized crime themselves. It typically involves group behavior, and usually can become systemic. Typically, if you see us in a particular area that policing is starting to engage in a certain kind of, often it starts opportunistically, but there's no comeback, nothing happens, there's no accountability, more and more officials can get involved in it, and they can start acting as a group. Protect each other when we're involved in this kind of corruption. And it's often seen as often spoken about as a case of bad apples. However, a lot of research now is demonstrating internationally that it's more related to organizational managerial shortcomings. That you can fix corruption in a police agency, it's not inevitable that you have to have a massive problem. But if you have the right strategies in place, if you have the right managerial capacity in place, you can tackle it and you can reduce the extent to which it occurs. And really, as I said, the key difference between different policing agencies is not whether there's corruption, but whether what its extent. And in some cases around the world, we see that actually entire police agencies can be described as corrupt, where virtually nothing can be done to get support or movement from a police agency, and you pay somebody money. That's not the case in South Africa, unfortunately. We don't think that okay, so that's just a couple of quotes there. Corruption is found in virtually all countries, in all forces, in every level of organization. A very well-renowned police analyst, Lawrence Sherman, said in 1978, the Modern Commission of New York Corruption to New York City Police Department found, what we found is that the problem of police corruption extends far beyond the corrupt cop. It is a multifaceted problem that has flourished not only because of opportunity and greed, but because of police culture that exalts loyalty over integrity because of willfully blind supervisors who fear the consequences of corruption scandal more than corruption itself, and because fears for the years in the New York City Police Department abandoned its responsibility to ensure the integrity of its members. And then, of course, very recently this year we've seen News of the World paying around 100,000 euros, Scotland Yard Police members paying equivalent of 100,000 euros in bribes to receiving bribes from journalists. So it's an ongoing challenge everywhere. So political corruption, it's very broad, and as I said, there's many ways that it can occur. The report is basically just going to give a few examples of the kind of things that can happen. Sometimes it can start very much, really just a misuse of authority for some kind of gain, accepting free lunches, holidays, and that kind of thing for using authority to benefit certain people. It can occur internally, procurement, promotion, shift allocations can happen where goods and favors exchanged for favorable shift allocations, for example. You have a shakedown where police officials might not accept a bribe and not going to arrest the suspect. There's something called fixing, which is often collecting evidence or selling documents to ensure prosecutions cannot be successful. There's large-scale protection of illegal activity in illicit markets, so accepting goods or cash on a regular basis to protect crime syndicates, drug dealing, illegal gambling, illegal sale of alcohol. Kickbacks, where police officials may refer particular individuals or suspects to particular lawyers or commission, tow truck drivers, or pay cops money to report accidents occurring. Opportunistic success, stealing from crime scenes, doing raid searches, visiting suspects. Padding, planting evidence, this is often called noble cause corruption, if police officials might be convinced that a certain person is guilty of something, they don't have the evidence, and they actually plant evidence for a person to try and ensure they get a conviction for them. And then direct criminal activities, police officials actually using their knowledge, access to skills and information to commit robberies, cash and transfers. That is the kind of range of corruption that can occur in any given police agency. And it's not an easy thing to necessarily address because it's caused by a variety of different factors. The research shows, international literature shows that there are three broad levels of factors that can come together to cause corruption or lead to a corruption problem in a policing agency. You have your environmental factors, the target environment in which policing takes place. We have large numbers of marginalized groups, people such as undocumented foreign nationals, sex workers, who are vulnerable on the edge of society, and they are not going to find favor, they report abuse. They often can be targeted. You have organized crime, illicit markets. Have then this illegal sale of alcohol, drugs, illegal gambling. When police then engage with people who are doing this, they will often, because of the amount of cash involved in this, almost always offer police officials money not to be arrested or not to interfere or to protect those ongoing activities. And then you'll have around the world inappropriate political influence, interference in the police service. During the 60s in America, one of the most egregious forms of wide scale police corruption occurred in some big cities like Chicago, Los Angeles. Because the mayor was appointing the police chief and the mayor was corrupt and was interfering in what the police were doing. Organizational dynamics include inadequate police leadership. It doesn't necessarily have to be poor police leadership, it's just inadequate to recognize the nature of the corruption challenge. Sometimes you have a lot of things, the paper look good, but you're not really addressing the key challenges around, especially building positive police culture and things like that, or really driving an anti-corruption strategy. You have poor management supervision. So issues around recruitment, training, promotions, career paths, weak discipline, internal accountability. If those dynamics exist in any way, they provide scope and gaps for corruption to occur. And then the police culture itself, internationally, you put people together in uniforms, there's a strong code of being, and often it can be a positive thing in policing. We're here to fight crime, we're working together, but it can also lead to a code of silence in which people don't want to talk about what their colleagues are doing. So even good police officials do not want to report on or assist investigations colleagues because you're in this together. Civilians don't always understand the challenges of policing, and that leads to what's often known as a blue wall of silence or code of silence. And that then allows corrupt cops to continue with their activities without being reported on by their colleagues. And then, of course, the individual factors such as incongruent personal attitudes, behavior that might be to risk taking, people who are already criminally predisposed, who might be recruited into the agency. If you have a problem with low morale, police officials start thinking, well, I'm not getting paid enough. Other people are corrupt, nothing happens to them. That can start leading to an attitude that allows police officials to start acting in ways that are not in line with organization's objectives. And sometimes there's people who just get involved in financial mismanagement. They suddenly have a huge debt to pay, they can't afford to pay their loans back, and it's very easy to make money, to take money, and that can be the breach of that happens. So you can see it's not one thing, it's range of different things that can influence corruption, and you might find that in different police agencies or different parts of the police agency that some of these dynamics are playing more of a role than others. But they all are candidates for all of these things. I think we often tend to sort of only think about corruption in South Africa as something that happened post-democracy, and this is certainly not true. South African police force, pre-democracy, during apartheid, was very insular and secretive, and there was little external accountability. So it's very difficult, therefore, to expose or identify corruption that's taking place within the police at that time. However, we did look at some research and some other sources of information which found systemic fraud and criminality taking place in the South African police force. Audited general reports, for instance, show increasing police fraud from 1966 onwards. Interestingly enough, the trial record of Eugene de Kock, most of the charges against him related to insurance, former free fraud, smuggling, and not actually violent crimes. And then, of course, there's all the research that's taken by Tom Lodge, which is Cape Town, looking at various parts of the infringement in exchange for bribes. And then there was evidence of widespread corruption in the Homeland Police Forces. These were led to merge into the South African Police Service, around 40,000 personnel, correct. So the South African Police Service started off with quite a challenge. Since democracy, the various sources of research that have taken place, and suggest that it's relatively widespread, it probably takes place in most parts of South Africa, taking place in the urban or big metropolitan areas. And in some cases, it's relatively systemic. When we say that, we mean that it's becoming almost like a habit. It's becoming opportunistic, but regularly so. And I've pointed some research that highlights that. I'll refer to some research surveys that have been taking place, and research studies. We've got the South African Police Service Policy Advisory Council in 2007-2008 that spoke about the insufficient capacity to investigate corruption. That was then the case in the South African Police Service. That advisory council report also noted that discipline is poor, code of conduct and ethics are not being adhered to, and that disciplining issues are not being dealt with timely. And then I'll speak just about some of the perceptions and experiences. So we see one of the indicators is around trust. Human Science and Research Council Social Attitude Survey showed that only 39% of respondents in 2007, the national survey, trust or strongly trusted the police, which means the majority didn't trust or trusted the police only a little bit. Our National Victims of Crime Survey 2007 also found that traffic fines was the single biggest experience that people said they had in terms of government corruption, followed by policing, where bribes were most often requested. About 20% for traffic fines, about half that for more police. The Afrobarometer survey showed that in 2008, the following year, that 46% of respondents believed that all or most police were corrupt, which is quite a high percentage of people, and that 54% trusted the police just a little or not at all. So these are very worrying things because they demonstrate that people's perceptions about the police are quite negative, and that's something we really have to change. And one of the perceptions that when you ask why people have those perceptions, they often talk about issues of corruption or not thinking the police are responding to them favorably. In 2009, the University of Witwatersrand undertook embedded research in Johannesburg, amongst a few police stations, and found that in visible policing, that 1 in 3 police civil engagements in Johannesburg police stations related to police eliciting a bribe from foreign nationals. That's to talk about when it starts becoming systemic, which becomes quite common practice. And then we did research last year into communities' experience and perception of police corruption, trying to answer a bit more detail as why the public were there to be a negative perception, such high level of negative perception. And we found that amongst the 35 focus groups that took in informal settlements, suburbs, townships, inner city areas, peri-urban areas in KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, and in Western Cape, there were quite significant levels of communities' experience of what they considered police police crime, where people are forced to hand over money to police or felt harassed or extort or experience extortion, leading to very negative perceptions in some communities of police is corrupt generally. We also found that of about the 50 specific cases that we mentioned in these focus groups, that only one of the community members said they tried to report it and they were successful in doing so at the police station. The other 49 did not try to report police corruption at all. And in 2011, Nielsen Research Service found that 1 in 3 said they paid a bribe to a traffic officer or police official in that urban area. So it is obviously clearly a problem, and this is reflected by internal perceptions. A Centre for Study of Violence and Reconciliation, inner city station level study, taken amongst police officials found that 55% of the police who put part of the study agree with state and police corruption is a problem at my station, and 32% said they had direct knowledge of a colleague involved in corrupt activities. A follow-up study amongst 21 stations of 600 uniformed police officials found that 92% believe that corruption was a serious challenge facing the organization as a whole. And I've referred to the police advisory council report's findings, and that 2009 study on the ISS, three police stations, 85% of members who were interviewed, so they found corruption to be a major problem in the South, but most of them didn't think that, and they didn't really know about anti-corruption initiative that's actually in the South African Police Service. They also didn't necessarily think that corruption is particularly bad in their particular station. So these perceptions and experience obviously point to a problem, but nowhere do you find that there isn't evidence that most police officials are corrupt or involved in corruption. And I think one of the challenges of doing this kind of work is that it tends to focus on negative outcomes. And certainly our work with police officials and the work that I was doing with the CSVR, generally found out that actually most police officials doing their job under very difficult circumstances, but they're not corrupt. And unfortunately, the size of the problem is too large, and it is causing too many people in the public realm to feel that it's a bigger problem than it might actually be. So a bit of a corruption timeline. We saw that the National Crime Prevention Strategy in 1996 first identified corruption in the criminal justice system and police corruption as a national priority, and that stage established the National Anti-Corruption Unit. Between 2000 and 2002, the capacity of this unit is reduced and it's closed down, and it's just to organize crime units and stations that will detect the digital corruption. Between 2002 and 2009, SAPS developed three different anti-corruption strategies. You see the National Service Integrity Strategy, followed by the Corruption and Fraud Prevention Strategy, and the Corruption and Fraud Prevention Plan. Little evidence of wide-scale implementation there. 2009, the Director of Priority Crime Investigation, or the Hawks, is established to place the Scorpions, and that has an anti-corruption mandate. In 2010, we see a particular low point with the introduction of the former National Commissioner, Jack Slavy, for corruption. But we start seeing an increase in anti-corruption statements from political and police leadership. And a new South African Police Service anti-corruption strategy is finalized, newsletters are released, and sensitization courses are being introduced. 2011, a bit of a down point with the Public Protective Point against the Cannings Commissioner, which leads to some negative perceptions there. And we also see some public statements around the head of crime intelligence, that this is increasing power for political purposes in his bail hearing for murder, and public statements being made about SAPS crime intelligence seeking information to organize crime so they could undermine Hawks investigation. The point of view is out because those kinds of reports that are reported very publicly really actually contribute to negative perception. So people who might not even actually come across personal, you know, police corruption or have no direct experience read this kind of stuff and they start thinking, the police are corrupt. I'm not going to go about the SAPS anti-corruption strategy. I've sent this to you 2 weeks ago. And I said at the stage SAPS weren't going to be here, but I let them present their own strategy. But basically, they're four pillars. It's quite a good looking strategy, and I think it demonstrates that the police taking this stuff quite seriously. So I'll not go into that in detail, let the police present their own strategy. I think we just want to point out one of our kind of ongoing areas that we think was what needed to be looked at quite carefully was anti-corruption unit within the Fire and Police Service. The previous unit established in 1996 was about 250 members across nine provinces. Its investigations tripled. They received about three times more cases in 2000. 6,480 cases received. They arrested 1,003 police members. In that year, they obtained 171 convictions. Capacity was shut down by half in 2001, and in many ways, international anti-corruption conferences that are held quite regularly, this unit used to report present at the conferences, and it's actually been seen as quite a good model. It had a number of organizational shortcomings, but nothing that couldn't have been rectified in our opinion, but it was eventually accused of being untransformed and focusing on petty corruption and was shut down. The problem was that when you're investigating police corruption, you're investigating police members who are corrupt. They know how investigations work, they know how corruption works, they know how to cover their tracks. So it's very difficult to investigate them if you don't have a specialist capacity around that. And that is why anti-corruption units like the Internal Affairs Bureau and the New York City Police Department, anti-corruption units in the Scotland Yard and others, they don't really expect members of the police to investigate each other. And I think that's what our concern is at the moment. We find that if it's petty corruption, Right now we have a hawk that investigates serious corruption against senior members of the police service or those involved in organized crime. But if you are a sergeant or a really ranking police official, and you could be involved in systemic or ongoing police corruption at a police station, if that comes to the attention or complaint you laid, it typically goes to another detective at a Navy station or a station. And it's very difficult for colleagues to investigate each other. They generally don't like doing so. It's not something that that police anywhere in the world want to do, obviously. And so sometimes quite serious cases of corruption amongst lowering officers don't actually get the kind of attention they might need. And where you and also people don't know where to respond or to report these cases. So with an anti-corruption, dedicated anti-corruption unit in the police service itself, staffed by very experienced, hand-picked policemen and women who've got integrity, now they've been police officials their whole lives, they know what the truth are, they know how things can hide, and their success rate can be actually far more effective at their corruption than external aid, especially when it comes to police. I think what we've seen is with the positive move is that internationally, when police management talk about corruption, they talk about rotten apples, rotten potatoes. However, in the more recently, we've seen the Minister of Police, talking about dealing with corruption. I quote, dealing with corruption is not just about dealing with individual cases and people that come to our attention, but also making sure our systems and processes are able to prevent corruption. We have General Taylor himself saying it's not been big on quality, we've been big on quantity. People have been thrown in by chasing quantity rather than quality. And we see in the South African Police Performance Plan for 2012, stated we need to ensure that we're able to recruit the right kind of people and to train the right people for the kind of cops we want to see. So, kind of recognition that the systems need to be improved, and that's probably and that's a big shift, because it really makes a big difference. If you're starting to just chase individual corrupt police officials and think that you can solve corruption that way, you're not going to get very far. You're constantly raising people. But if you think about the systems that allow police officials to be proud of the work they're doing, to have a professional culture and to move forward, that's the best way to try and deal with it. And here we just talk about leadership, and I think that's important here. So it's important, obviously, for the Minister, the National Commissioner, to develop a drive vision for SAPS of an agency that's widely respected because all its members adhere to high standards of professional conduct and integrity, and the SAPS leadership must consistently act to promote police professionals by tackling misconduct that occurs, poor service delivery and corruption immediately. And that systems, regulations, the policies are in place, and that everybody understands that they're there. And that, of course, that the implementation of these systems and must be independently verified, such as by the Auditor General, Public Service Commission, and reported on before Parliament. And then, of course, what we say is all police commanders, especially at station level, must be held directly accountable, both for themselves behaving in line with the core values of the South African Police Service, but also holding those under their command accountable. And sometimes what happens is when a case or complaint against a particular police official happens, low ranking police official, all the change is on that person. Did they break the rules? Did they commit a crime? No one's looking at what was that person's supervisor manager doing? Were they providing good role models? Were they providing good stewardship and guidance? Were they being the kind of manager that would make a police official want to respect and follow their leadership? And I think until we start really looking at the kind of decision points and the system in which police officials operate, when we're dealing with corruption cases, we're going to miss some of the key issues and how to solve it. And we think that really the three key areas for promoting police professionals and enhancing accountability. It's important that the system for receiving, processing, and analyzing complaints are good, so that, because the reality is that even with your internal investigation units or very good investigators, a lot of corruption, a lot of police misconduct occurs where it's not easy to substantiate. So you get a lot of unsubstantiated cases. So if it's a civilian's word against a police official and there's no evidence, no witnesses, it becomes unsubstantiated. But if you do have systems for recording complaints or recording positive feedback about police behavior, you can start identifying which stations, which units, which kind of corruption are taking place in which parts of Africa. Then it allows you for a much better focused and proactive approach on TV testing and that kind of thing. So it's important to have a very good system for receiving complaints. A while back, when we looked at this, it looked like the components for dealing with complaints were different to the components for investigating complaints, and what happens in the different systems were not in one kind of clear system to see what's happening and how these things work. Well, I've spoken about the anti-corruption unit, and there needs to be an improvement in terms of the management systems. But that's the accountability, the negative accountability. Positive accountability is probably more important. Really, you should have a situation where the biggest threat to a corrupt cop is an honest cop, and not the other way around. Really want to see police officials embrace the core values that are evident in all police work, and we want to see good, hard-working honesty and will be recognized and supported. Particularly those that report corruption must be singled out for particular prayers. There was actually a case the other day, the UB yesterday morning, a Hawks investigator was offered some individuals 2 million rand and turned it down. I mean, those men and women exist in our police service, and we really need to nourish them and make them the role models, because they're there and they need to be supported. And of course, training for managers to know, so they know how to do command and control, know how to provide the kind of positive leadership that they're important in policing. And then promoting community engagement. The public need to know that they mustn't tolerate bad policing, they must report bad policing, but they must also be part of the solution. They mustn't just be complaining about police. If they get good service from a policeman or woman, they must really go out of their way to say thank you. They should write letters to the public commanders, they should refer to radio shows, they should talk about it to their friends. And that's pretty much where we're going with our campaign. That comes out of this research. I'm going to, we found two things. We found that members of the communities weren't reporting bad things either, but even when you start engaging them about the sort of the problematic policing experience might have had, at some point they would often talk about and have a direct conversation with people about this, where they'd say, well, eventually they did come across the police officer to help. But the overall story starts negative, and somewhere along the line there was somebody actually went out of their way to help them. And very few people actually saying thank you or kind of making a point of doing anything about good police police experiences. We think that's really important for building a positive police culture and in generating professional police. So what we've done is we've launched, it happened 2 weeks ago, we had a great support from the Minister of Police and the Secretary of Police, such as we represented there as well, we had police unions, we had Paramount Board, and it's ready to do that campaign. The objectives are to create awareness around the importance of supporting professional policing, good policing, and create awareness about the importance of supporting poor service or poor criminality in the police. It's about educating the role of the police in creating a safe and secure environment so people can realize that the police play a critical role and can play a critical role in the community. And it's to really contribute to building a morale police service as accountable to the public. And if the public wants to support the police, they don't see the police as corrupt, they see the police as professional men and women who are there to assist them. So, I'm just going to go, just to speak about some of the kind of dynamics of the campaign, the power of gratitude. This comes out of a book that my colleague Andrew Paul, who's joined Coles on this report, he published last year. We spoke to a whole number of police men and women across the country to get a sense of, it's called Behind the Badge, what are police experiences like? That often doesn't come through in lots of the research. So, here a couple of quotes. In the police service, there's no money. The only thing that makes you feel is good when people see you serve, come and thank you and say, you've done a good job, well done. Even though they're not giving you anything, their words just to me a thank you. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you've got money, even though you don't. That's comfortable to do. I believe in what I do. Circumstances are not always the way you want them to be, but you need to get past that and carry on doing what you believe in. Sometimes I think to myself, it's really worth it, but then there'll be one little incident, where you help someone and the gratitude that person shows you makes you think, wow, and you carry on. That's why I'm. And sometimes you know why a community doesn't say thank you, and sometimes you need them to say thank you. Some police are very negative. The people can't say thank you when you have a negative attitude, but you need to say thank you when you're nice to them and when they're satisfied. So that's just something that's sort of coming out of our engagement with police, and also that police do have good experiences. So what we're doing is using traditional media. We're going to be using, we've already started with Rank Radio, Taxi Rank, 29 of the biggest taxi ranks in South Africa. Get this message out there, promote positive policing, say thank you to good reward a cop, support a cop. You have good experience, please say thank you, please support those police officials. You have that experience, this is how you can support it safely and effectively. Using social media such as the Facebook, Twitter, and stuff like that, Twitter. Using websites, the website I'm running for this. And on the website, there's a whole range of downloadable products. The research we'll be talking about is available there, but also how do you report, what is the police code of conduct, ways of reporting, how you say thank you to police officials, how you can support them in doing good work, that's all there, and we want to share that and disseminate that. And we're working in partnership with the Crime Line and others. The campaign that we've got funding for will last now until December, and we just really hope that it will start shifting kind of what we call civic culture, that people really start to get good service and start doing a lot more about it. In the presentation, let's just give you some demonstration of what some of these things look like, the website portal, and where you can access some of these different guides and other products. We were looking at doing some kind of piloting amongst specific communities so we can really start seeing if this has an impact, and we're busy in negotiations now with potential funders so that we can actually go into specific communities. show them how to say thank you, show them how police are, how important it is to work with good police, and how important they are, say bad police officials, and see what kind of dynamic we can get going there. And I think I'll end it there, but I think that it's something that we, it's a fraught area. We, when we've been speaking to media about this, sometimes they focus on the positive stuff, sometimes they focus on the negative stuff, but I want to assure the committee and members of the police service that our intentions are to really build a positive understanding of police culture, and we really want to assist the police in what they're doing, and we have a track record of doing that already. Thank you very much for inviting us to present to you.
Thank you very, very much. Quite interesting.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Chair, earlier I was caught off guard and omitted to acknowledge with appreciation the words of congratulations and commendations by yourself on the reduction of crime as recorded in our statistics which were released last week, Thursday. We really appreciate. Honourable Chairperson, you wanted to know as to whether there is some work that is done within the SAPS, and the answer is yes, Chairperson, there is some work that is done on the SAPS. Honourable members, please allow me to present an overview on the anti-corruption strategy of the SAPS. This presentation will include the key elements of the anti-corruption strategy, but will also include some background information to contextualize the issues that were taken into consideration during the development of the strategy. Namely, Cabinet approved the minimum anti-corruption capacity requirements, or MAC. The result of an audit undertaken by the Department of Public Service and Administration during 2009 and 2010 will give an indication of the SAPS extent of compliance with the MAC as determined by the DPSA. A description of the process for the development of the anti-corruption strategy will also be provided, after which a brief explanation of the four pillars of the strategy will follow. This will include the priorities, objectives, current and planned implementation initiatives per pillar. And lastly, there will be a way forward for the conclusion of the strategy, which will then complete the presentation. Honourable Chair, the MAC developed by the DPSA and approved by Cabinet in 2003 provides the basic standard for all departments regarding the establishing and maintaining of a minimum capacity to combat corruption within each department. The MAC provides a comprehensive guideline on what should be included within each of the four pillars towards the effective combating of corruption. This slide talks to the process for the development of the SAPS anti-corruption strategy. As indicated earlier, the DPSA conducted an audit on the minimum anti-corruption requirements. SAPS was also assessed, and it was found to be 69% compliant with the MAC in the 7th position overall of 27 national departments involved in the audit. Subsequent to that, an internal national workshop was conducted to consult to develop a strategy, a review of the strategy that we had. Consultation and sensitization processes are underway. The development and refinement of elements of the anti-corruption strategy within the four pillars. The anti-corruption strategy was presented at the SAPS National Management Forum on the 30th of June 2011. The forum instructed, given the importance of the prevention pillar, that it should be strengthened to specifically enhance support given by management to members in the prevention of corruption.
The revised prevention pillar was subsequently distributed to all levels within the SAPS for input. The strategy will then be presented to the National Management Forum for final approval by the end of September. This slide reflects the aim of the four pillars of the anti-corruption strategy. The anti-corruption strategy comprises four pillars as required by MEC, namely prevention, detection, investigation, and resolution. The first pillar, that talks to prevention, focuses on developing a culture in the SAPS that is professional and does not tolerate corruption and criminality. We regard within the SAPS the prevention pillar as the most important of the four pillars, hence it has been prioritized by the top management of the SAPS. The detection pillar has its purpose, the proactive detecting of corruption and fraud, specifically within the SAPS, but also within departments in the JCPS cluster. The investigation pillar emphasizes the need to ensure that all reports of corruption are investigated effectively and efficiently. This includes criminal charges for corruption against fraud involving SAPS members, but also allegations of corruption or fraud made to the SAPS. The resolution of corruption will counteract the effects of corruption primarily through the application of disciplinary measures against members involved in corruption or fraud, but also through improving internal controls to prevent the recurrence of corruption and fraud. I will be talking to the prevention pillar. Under the prevention pillar, we identify priority number one being to develop and implement an integrity management framework for the SAPS. I indicated earlier that we regard the prevention pillar as the most important of the four pillars, as prevention is undoubtedly better than cure. The first priority within the pillar is the establishing of an integrity management framework for the SAPS to institutionalize professional and ethical conduct. This priority includes the establishing of an ethics and integrity management capacity within the SAP. The second objective of the integrity management framework is to ensure managerial assistance to members in the prevention of corruption and fraud, to empower them with the skills and knowledge required to avoid unethical, unprofessional, and criminal corrupt conduct, including coordinating the sensitization of members on the nature, the cause of unprofessional and criminal corrupt conduct. The third objective is to identify, assess, and manage the risks related to unethical, unprofessional, and criminal conduct by SAPS members. This will address the analyzing of allegations of corruption and unethical conduct within specific functional areas, as well as analyzing of statistics on reported charges of corruption and fraud within SAPS to enable the SAPS to identify those areas prone to corruption and fraud. Objective number four focuses on managing the SAPS corruption prevention policies and procedures, including a gift policy which was recently revised, regulating gifts to individual SAPS members in line of their duty. A whistleblowing policy in line with the Protected Disclosures Act. A corrupt reporting incentive policy which will manage non-monetary incentives to members reporting criminality, corruption, and fraud within the SAPS. The final objective under this priority is the supporting of the anti-corruption strategy with targeted research, which will focus on the nature, causes, and consequences of unethical and unprofessional conduct by SAPS members, including all forms of criminality, corruption, and fraud, ways in which unethical and unprofessional conduct of SAPS members, including all forms of criminality, corruption, and fraud, ways in which unethical, unprofessional conduct by SAPS members, including all forms of criminality, corruption, and fraud can be prevented. A continuation of the prevention pillar, priority number two, talks to communication of the anti-corruption strategy. As we proceeded, we noticed that one area where we were lacking was communication on the anti-corruption strategy, hence this priority. The communication plan for the anti-corruption strategy will help both an internal, that is within the SAPS, and also an external focus. The first in this priority is the launch of the Lookout campaign to create awareness amongst members, which will be launched on the 9th of December 2011. The Lookout campaign will focus on providing members with an explanation of the definition of corruption and fraud, the causes and consequences of corruption and fraud within the SAPS. Importantly, how and where corruption and fraud involving SAPS members can be reported, including the promoting of whistleblowing, the popularizing of the SAPS gift policy and register through internal communication tools. The Lookout campaign will also include recognition of good work done by members and will publicly demonstrate the commitment of the SAPS to clean and effective governance. The second objective under this priority is the external communication of corruption awareness and reporting with existing and new community-based partners, for example, the South, Thai Media, CPF, and Business Against Crime. Priority number three under the prevention pillar, to monitor and evaluate the anti-corruption strategy. The objective within this priority is the monitoring and evaluating of the implementation of the strategy. The SAPS will, on an annual basis, use an assessment framework to determine the extent of compliance of the anti-corruption strategy with the MEC. The assessment framework will be based on the framework used by the DPSA to assess all government departments' extent of compliance with the MEC. The DPSA requires that every government assess its compliance with the MEC on an annual basis and has indicated that it will commission an assessment of the extent of compliance with the MEC by an independent body every 3 years. There will also be benchmarking of the anti-corruption strategy with the strategies of other government departments, which will also be conducted on an annual basis, focusing on those departments that could provide the SAPS with ways in which the anti-corruption strategy could be improved. The following indicators will be used on a quarterly and annual basis for evaluating the extent of criminality, including corruption and fraud in the SAPS. The number of SAPS members charged and arrested criminally for corruption and fraud. The number of guilty and not guilty verdicts against SAPS members. The court ready case docket rate for corruption and fraud charges against SAPS members. And the number of SAPS members charged departmentally in terms of the SAPS discipline regulations for corruption and fraud. The last objective, the conducting of annual impact evaluation studies aimed at specifically at determining the extent and effectiveness of the implementation of the anti-corruption strategy, will be crucial to ensuring the strategy impacts positively on combating corruption within the SAPS. This slide is also a continuation of the prevention pillar, which talks to the current implementation. The current implementation within the prevention pillar includes several initiatives. Corruption and fraud by SAPS members has been prioritized as a strategic risk for the SAPS linked to the revised Strategic Plan 2010-2014. The National Risk Committee manages the development and implementation process of the anti-corruption strategy as a whole, ensuring that there is a coordinated approach at level in the SAPS. I can also indicate that I do chair the National Risk Committee chairperson. Public statements have been made by the minister, the deputy minister, the national management of the SAPS on the zero tolerance approach to corrupt SAPS members. These statements have also been communicated extensively in the SAPS, and arrests were also effected in other areas. Ethics officers have been designated at national and provincial levels to promote integrity and ethical conduct in the SAPS, advise management and members on ethical matters, and identify and report unethical conduct to the SAPS. An anti-corruption communication plan has been put in place to coordinate the internal and external communication of the anti-corruption strategy. This includes communicating with members regarding the consequences of corruption and the need to maintain professional conduct. The sensitization of members was initiated on 1 January 2011, and to date, a total of 37,387, which reflects 19.2%, members have been sensitized at all levels. Existing anti-corruption skills development modules are provided to SAPS members, including the 2011 entry-level members trained on the new sensitization module and the employee health and wellness, work ethics and anti-corruption module. I omitted to talk to the recruitment process, which is a bullet earlier. The SAPS recruitment process has been strengthened to improve quality of entry-level members, including community involvement in the selection process and the vetting of applicants, which was not done before. An integrity testing module is currently under development to strengthen the selection and recruitment process, and this is done by our psychological services. Customized employee health and wellness support programs are implemented that directly impact on anti-corruption initiatives on the support thereof. Consultation with all levels on the further development of the prevention pillar, including the integrity management framework, has been undertaken and will be finalized after the due date of the 16th September 2011. A circular that was sent out has given them till the 16th for submission of inputs. Planned implementation on the prevention pillar. Our planned implementation within the prevention pillar includes the implementation of corruption prevention policies subsequent to the approval of the anti-corruption strategy, which will be presented at the management forum after finalization. These policies include inter alia, the gift policy, and register to individual SAPS members and whistleblowing policy. The planned launch of the anti-corruption strategy on International Anti-Corruption Day on the 9th of December. Both the communication strategy that talks to the anti-corruption strategy together with the anti-corruption strategy will be launched on the same day. An ethics and integrity endeavor is planned to be held by March 2012 and will focus on developing a common understanding of the ethics and integrity requirements of police officers. I can mention that amongst the team that I got with Chairperson, we have got members that form part of the committee that is working on the activities of the endeavor that is under planning. We will finalize the formal anti-corruption skills development courses for all levels, including management development courses and courses for corruption investigators. Earlier, I indicated that we have already started a training level So there will be finalization of the formal anti-corruption skills development courses for all levels within the organization. We will conduct research regarding the public perceptions of corruption and impact evaluation. We will establish a center for service excellence within the SAPS to coordinate reports of unprofessional service delivery and commendations for service for good service delivery. Safe to say, our structure within the communication component already includes a directorate that will be focusing on the center for service excellence. The detection pillar. This is the second pillar in the proposed anti-corruption strategy. The first priority under this pillar will involve the managing of reports and allegations of corruption made to the SAPS. This will include developing a centralized information management system to capture allegations of corruption made to the SAPS. At present, allegations of corruption are received from a number of sources, and it is not always possible for SAPS to ensure that these reports are followed up and properly investigated. The reports of corruption are made to the SAPS, that are made to the SAPS must be effectively investigated once captured, including reports received from the Public Service Commission Anti-Corruption Hotline, the Presidential Hotline, and reports received from whistleblowers within the SAPS. Finally, under this priority, the SAPS must ensure that it is compliant with the corruption reporting requirements as prescribed by the MEC, which is a requirement. This reporting involves disclosing to the Department of Public Service and Administration what reports of corruption have been received by the SAPS and the actions taken by the SAPS in investigating these reports. The second priority under detection pillar talks to the effective detection of corruption within the staff. The conduction of risk assessments to identify those areas that may be prone to corruption will assist the SAPS in putting preventive charges of criminality, preventive measures in place. The analysis of the detailed information regarding criminal charges of criminality, including corruption and fraud as maintained on the SAPS crime management information system, will be done on a quarterly basis to identify trends regarding the perpetration of corruption by SAPS members and corruption prone areas. The role played by crime intelligence, the inspectorate, and internal audit is also crucial in detecting corruption and will be integrated into a coordinated approach. Current implementation within the detection pillar. The risk-based audits and inspections by the internal audit component and inspectorate respectively. The internal audit component is guided by the strategic risk register of the SAPS, which has corruption and fraud involving SAPS members as a priority risk. One is to mention also that within the SAPS, we ensured that throughout there are risk registers as form of compliance with the National Treasury instructions. Corruption and fraud risk assessments conducted by divisions and provinces based on all allegations of corruption received and data from the Crime Management Information System. Managing reports of corruption and fraud received from the Ministry, the Secretary of Police, the Presidential Hotline, and the National Anti-Corruption Hotline is continuous. The management of complaints of unprofessional conduct by SAPS members from the ICD and those reported to the inspectorate, and the profiling and vetting of those members by crime intelligence and the DPCR. Planned implementation on the detection pillar. We plan updating the current information system to allow for ease of reporting for corruption and fraud. We also intend doing an analysis of the current data to determine the trend to to support the detection of corruption and fraud. We will also be conducting a lifestyle audit focusing on corruption and fraud. The third pillar, the investigation pillar. The third pillar of the anti-corruption strategy will focus on the effective investigation of cases of corruption and fraud, prioritizing those perpetrated by members of the SAPS. The first priority relates to criminal charges of corruption and fraud against SAPS members that are involved in organized and commercial crime dimension, or that are those that are involved in the procurement irregularities of fraud, where an estimated value equal to or exceeding 5 million rand is involved. These charges will be prioritized and consequently will be investigated by the DPCI, the HOPE. The DPCI will also investigate similar criminal charges involving members of all departments within the JCPS cluster as prioritized by the President. The effective investigation of other criminal charges of corruption and fraud, the second priority in the investigation of pillar, will be dealt with by the detective service capacity within the SAPS at provincial and station level. The third priority will be ensuring the effective managing of corruption investigations throughout the course of each individual investigation to improve the court registered docket rate into corruption and fraud investigations involving SAPS members. The ensuring of effective cooperation with other government departments during corruption investigations within the court process will broaden the scope of investigations and ensure that all available resources are used towards securing conviction. The current implementation on the investigation pillar within the SAPS. Within the SAPS, the current implementation of the investigation pillar includes registered charges against SAPS members by detective services, the DPCI, and internal investigation of disciplinary cases. We have seen a lot of arrests effected by our own SAPS members, to our own members. The investigation of corruption and fraud within the JCPS cluster has been prioritized and directed by the President. The management of outstanding criminal charges of corruption and fraud against SAPS members will improve the court-ready case docket rate and the detection rate. Finally, a feasibility study has been approved to be conducted with the intention of ensuring that we re-establish the anti-corruption unit. The resolution pillar being the last pillar of the anti-corruption strategy. The first priority under this pillar is the effective management of the disciplinary cases. The first objective. The first objective is to finalize internally generated and IPID referred departmental disciplinary cases against members for corruption and fraud within the set time frame. Priority number two is to ensure improving internal control. The objective here is to review the SAPS policies and procedures which are compromised by corruption and fraud. And priority number three, the recovery of losses. The final priority in this pillar refers to the recovery of losses suffered by the SAPS as a result of corruption and fraud. And the current situation is that the SAPS has an effective loss management policy and procedure in place and will ensure that there is compliance with this policy and procedure to ensure the recovery of those losses. Current implementation of the resolution pillar. Disciplinary trial structures and units were approved and implemented. Previously, our structures did not cater for dedicated structures that deal with discipline. We recently approved structures that deal with cases, disciplinary cases. A total of 479 departmental charges and disciplinary cases against SAPS members were recorded in 2010-2011. The existing system to recover losses incurred by the SAPS as a result of corruption and fraud by the SAPS members. The planned intervention in terms of the resolution pillar. Enhancement of the loss management system to specify recoveries for losses as a result of corruption and fraud by the SAPS members. And also improving the systems and controls compromised by corruption and fraud to avoid recurrence. The last slide, Honorable Chairperson, talks to the way forward. Our way forward will be to ensure that the anti-corruption strategy, which is currently under review, that talks to the four pillars, is finalized and presented for approval before the National Management Forum. That will be followed by the implementation plan for the phased implementation of the strategy. And there will be a monitoring and evaluation of the implementation and the impact of the strategy. That will be focusing on the achievement of objectives and targets in line with the performance of the indicators. Madam Chair, the presentation on the anti-corruption strategy of the SAPS has rightly indicated that it is currently under review. Safe to say that does not necessarily mean that nothing is happening within the organization. The presentation also talks to activities that are currently taking place within the organization. It ends here. I thank you all.
Thank you very, very much, General. I will take hands, Honorable Edu, Honorable Nicola Banat, Honorable Annelies, Honorable Swate, Honorable Lichet, Honorable Reverend Mishra. We will please let's preamble. Let's ask questions so that we can have time for the three presenters or organizations or delegations to respond to our questions. But I, however, will allow a 5 minute break. When we come back, people have pointed and will then begin to talk. Just 5 minutes,
please. You made mention of the relationship with other institutions. Now, my question is, will this not compromise the independence of the agency? And a series of questions goes to that. My first one is anti-corruption communication plan. When was it established and what is the success rate thus far? And when have you established this training for corruption? Still on SAP, you made mention of the detection pillar with three bullets. None of them shows when
Council for Advancement of the SA Constitution, perhaps. As the speaker who is behind me, I'm sorry, I feel very rude, but I have to talk into the mic, apologies. The constitutional need for an independent anti-corruption unit was intensely interrogated some years back, and the result of those deliberations was the unit dubbed the Scorpion, and indeed that unit was then killed off because of its own successes. Now, the fact that it investigated without fear or favour, which had many high-profile characters and MPs even under investigation, led to its demise. Now, all these issues were debated at that time and dealt with. So how does what you have outlined here differ to what this country had at that stage under the Scorpions? I mean, what is the difference? Because everything that you said there, I recall, was covered by that unit. Are we not reinventing the wheel here? Because virtually all the bodies you referred to spoke at the hearings against the closure of the Scorpions. Now they're speaking up and saying, yes, this is the unit we must have. Please tell me if you see that there are differences between what we had previously and then shut down to what we're looking at now. And then moving on to the SAP. I see on page 17, you refer to the resolution pillar, where there are 479 cases against SAP's members last year. Yet there is nothing that says or gives any indication of the outcomes of those cases or some indication that the outcome is something to be feared by a SAP member. Are there SAP members from that 479 who were dismissed and then arrested for corruption? There is a sense that SAP tends to deal with matters such as this internally, and that they're somehow SAP members are treating a court along a different set of criteria to those with which civilians are treated. So how many of the 479 were found guilty? How many of them arrested? And are there those who've been found guilty of corruption and yet remain within the SAP? And those 479 cases, would you say that was the tip of the iceberg, considering the previous, wherever the young gentleman is, the previous presentation, which said that the majority of South Africans say they have either had a bribe extorted from them or given a bribe, and that they do not believe SAP's members on the whole are honest people. And finally, about your anti-corruption units. You're saying here, after all these years, you want to re-establish the anti-corruption units. I want to know what the delay has been. Jackie Salebi shut them down for his own ends forever ago, years ago, and yet we're sitting here with no anti-corruption units. Can you tell us, can you give us deadlines, frame, when? When will they be established, and what size will these units be? Will they be big enough to deal with the issue at hand? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yeah. I want to thank the attending just for the deliberate presentation. I am, however, worried, and I would like both the Constitutional Group Council, as well as its comments on it. I'm worried about the silence on the corrupt debt, the person paying the bribe, person soliciting the act. And I think that's something that we found also in media reports, that it's easy to concentrate on the official, it's easy to concentrate on whether it's a DG or a sergeant, doesn't matter. But we don't hear and we don't see enough about do not pay bribes, do not solicit contracts illegally, etc., etc. And what are we doing about that? Suggestions that you have around that. To then to go to SAP, I'm not sorry. You know, discipline process takes far too long in SAP. What are you doing in terms of this new strategy to ensure that the disciplinary process is where fraud and corruption are indicated, are actually dealt with timeously, speedily, and decisively. Because I can't gather from the presentation that this is addressed specifically. Yes, you said you're now establishing specific disciplinary bodies that will deal with this. Second issue there, you said, listen, for me the focus lies with middle management, and it lies with management, from a national, provincial, station level. And it's good to say we are going to, and we started to train at basic training already. We all know that that gets out of the door once the person enters a station. And it gets down to the basic things of doing a day's honest job in a proud manner to earn your salary. Now, if a station manager is not inducing that ethos within a station, you can have the best formulated plan ever. It's not going to work. And if a provincial inspectorate goes to a station, as we have seen, do some findings, and you now put them, they are pillar, they're one of your focus points, they're one of the points that is going to address corruption. Yet the station ignores whatever this inspectorate has found. We've seen that ourselves with our visit to Gauteng. How are you going to strengthen the role of the inspectorate and to really be able to play this pivotal role that you now see them playing? Then, Jefferson, if I might also, in terms of corruption in SAP, I agree with the Institute of State Security, the corrupt, that we have many, many, many good police officers. We won't have the reduction in crime that we have if we didn't have those good police officers. But the reality of the matter is also that I agree also that the system is the problem, and that the system allows. And part of that is career pathing and promotion. And unless, and I see we've got a new face again, career pathing and personnel, unless we address that, because it must be frustrating to be at a station. This committee visits the station. The committee finds Arkwright and SAP 13 stores in a mess. At that same station, you have a detective with a 90% plus success rate and serious and violent crimes. When promotion comes, that person who was in charge of that SAP 13 stores in the archive are the one that gets promoted, and the detective is the one that does not get promoted. That opens the system, and I want to know how the system is going to be corrected from the beginning to a person in order for an honest police officer to know if I do my work, if I do what is expected of me, if I do over and above my responsibilities, I will be up for promotion. I will not have to get demotivated and actually get involved in crime. One last one. IPED's role with the new definition of IPED for me is totally underplayed in SAP's presentation, because we've given IPED a specific role in terms of corruption as well, and I don't see the role coming to the fore in SAP's policy.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presenters. I'll start with my first question straight to the CASAC with regard to the independent anti-corruption agency that they are actually proposing, that they think that if we can go that route, some of the problem could be solved. So I just want to know how is their view, their view in terms of what we had, the corruption anti-corruption agency that was there in the SAPS. How is it going to differ with what they actually are proposing? What's going to be the difference, and what maybe made them to come up with this new one? Because there was this agency unit that was in the SAPS. So I just want clarity in terms. And my second question is with regard to the anti-corruption strategy that actually Lieutenant General has just indicated in terms of what she was saying, that she actually outlined some of the plans that they intend doing going forward. But she also said that it doesn't mean that they are not doing enough now, or they are not doing anything now in terms of try to combat corruption. So I just want to find out, because she didn't actually clearly tell us how many cases did they solve so far in terms of what they are doing now. She only tells us what they are going to do in the near future. So I just want her maybe to come clear on that one, to tell us exactly when she said that they are doing something now, not only focusing in the future. And another question is with regard to the ISS. On their side here, they said that we cannot say they say SAF cannot be said to be a corrupt organization. But what I want to know, because when you go down in terms of they are saying so many things that actually show in the direction that people don't have confidence in SAF in terms of various structures that did investigations and those who were doing research. But I just want to find out from ISS in terms of the percentage. Because if we're saying there are so many studies conducted within SAP by independent organizations, but they have found out that there are so many people who are not satisfied with how the how corruption is being they've been fighting corruption. So I just need them maybe to come out and tell us the percentage, because that's where we can actually know as to whether is it 50-40 or is it 50-50 or is it 70-30, so that we can know if they're saying that it is not something that it is we can say it is a corrupt structure. But according to what they are actually outlining, it shows that people don't have confidence. And there might be this possibility that majority of people or other people could be saying differently or maybe seeing success as something that is corrupt. So I think maybe they need also to tell us, because when I'm looking into what they explain here, it seems there are many structures that actually see that differently. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also echo what honourable members have been saying, to thank the presenters. Yes, corruption undermines our democracy. And I'm very happy to hear from the subspeople that they're implementing the lifestyle audit. Secondly, to the very same SAPS, we reported 479 charges. Can you maybe put that province by province for me so that it becomes detailed? Also, Chair, I'm very, very happy to hear from the Council for Advancement of South African Constitution, when they propose a national dialogue, and that goes with public education. I think to involve the public is very, very critical. I agree with them that we need definitely the national dialogue and educate the people so that they take a charge. Chairperson, the council says the sole criteria for prostitution should be sufficiency of evidence. I agree, because in most of the cases, people are being victimized, they are suspended without sufficient evidence, only to be left, and that puts a different department in. Can you please detail what you mean by sufficiency of evidence? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Justice. My first question goes to Kazakh. they referred to the Lenista judgment where an order was given to Parliament to make amendments to the legislation that deals with the Hawks to make it more independent. Now, that judgment did not refer to starting a new agency to deal with corruption, but strengthening and correcting what already existed. So I want to know from CASAC whether they do not think that such an approach would work, when they would prefer a totally new, dedicated, independent agency to deal with corruption. What we already have, can that not be remedied where it is just fault and shortcomings? And my second question goes to SAPS. When we look at the strike plan that's given, very, very impressive, but they does not have timelines. Talking about your finalizing and approving ACS, but we don't know when is that going to happen. It's happening next year, in 3 years' time, when is that going to happen? So I think timeline would be very helpful. And thirdly, we all know that discipline has been a major issue of concern within SAPS. Dealing with discipline takes forever. And ISS has said that the codes of conduct and ethics are not adhered to. Now, problems such as these are not addressed by the threat plan. So I would want to know what is going to be done to ensure that the codes of conduct and ethics are being adhered to, and that the discipline does not take forever. And lastly, that there's a perception that senior management is untouchable when it comes to issues of corruption and so on. So when the public complains that nothing has been done to senior management, only the lower rank appears to be targeted, what can be done? What is that going to do to ensure that the public confidence that corruption is going to be wiped out and on them is restored? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And all the presenters. My questions are directed to General in particular. General, I don't want to assume. You have on slide number 9, amongst you the points that you raised, or the subheadings that you raised, you have a recruitment process. And in the recruitment process, you are going to, amongst the criteria, one of the criteria that you are going to use is the involvement of the community in the selection process. I would like to, as I think I said, I don't want to assume, how is the community going to be involved in the selection process? And the other one, General, is the issue of when we go to stations, amongst the complaints or the challenges that the stations raise is the shortage of vehicles. I'm pushing this to you, General, with severe sadness. I witnessed a very horrible incident on the 4th of this month where a child was knocked down by a police car, and the person who was in this car, and to say to you, General, that that car is a write-off. It's a brand new car, it's a write-off, which I have the registration thereof. The person who was in that car was a rebelist. He knocked down this child, the child was killed, and when I arrived at the scene, I thought maybe this the cordoning, because it had pulled the fence. But I asked myself, what kind of cordoning is this? Whether it was, which is done with the fence. For me to find that it pulled the fence and took it out, General. So I'd like to find out,
I tried to get the station commander for that particular, where the particular vehicle comes from. I couldn't get hold of that person to date. So I'd like to find out what is it that you do in terms of this, because I believe it's one of the corruption at its best, general, where you have, that's where a matter of control and command comes in, which is part of which is one of your areas that you identified as a weakness, if I recall well. What is it that you are good? What is being done by staff?
Thank you, Jefferson. May I ask one question from Council? Is that they talk about political will to fight corruption. What do they mean by that? Political will to fight corruption. Do they mean it should involve corruption? Do they involve politicians or do they not involve politicians? What do they mean? Political will to fight corruption. Constitutionally, they say that there are some bodies that should stand alone. In this country, most of the people who are over 18 are the voters of this country. They have a right to vote and not to vote. If you say a person should be independent and stand alone, what does that mean? Does it mean, therefore, he mustn't participate in some other activities? Or what should he do? Or she? That's the first question. The second question goes to the police chairperson. Do they include other stakeholders then, like the ISS, if they are dealing with these projects? I call them project chairperson because of two things. One is that if you talk about strategies, you need people from inside and you need people from outside. There are people who may see things differently because they are coming from outside the police, and there are people who can assist. If you look at ISS perceptions of people who have already conducted, whom the ISS conducted research, and you see the strategy that has been put by the police, you find that there is a different of opinion in it. Do they use the other stakeholders in conducting these or establishing these strategies in making sure that what is happening outside their perimeter, they are able to catch it? Thank you, Chairman.
No, thank you very, very much. I think. The question members are asking is, what is it that you're going to do differently this time in the implementation of this strategy? So that probably we believe that probably something better is going to happen. Even if it means reducing corruption, what is it that you're going to do differently? You said, I mean, over this weekend on Sunday, I attended an Imbizo in Goma. And you listen carefully as community members raise issues, and I'm talking about ordinary people, literally saying so-and-so is doing 1, 2, 3, so-and-so is doing 1, 2, 3, it is no, and nothing is being done about this member. And in actual fact, he's actually making this whole police station to look very corrupt, because he's been saying these things repeatedly and nobody is attending to it. Talking about something that was said to me just in front. As a matter of fact, I asked the province to give us a report as to what are the issues related to these people who were named and not for the first time, involving almost everything that you can think of that is wrong in SAR. But they are members of SAR, and possibly they could have been promoted in the past. So I'm just asking, really, I'm also interested to know, too, what is it that you're going to do better this time around? I fully agree with members, and probably with the ISS when they say there's lack of accountability and consequences for any wrongdoing and lack of monitoring the implementation of these policies. For me, it will yet be another document sent to police stations and that is all. It will lie there and nobody is going to ensure that it is implemented to the latter, and if not implemented, there are consequences. Nobody is going to do that. And that is the problem. That is where we're missing the whole thing. Because as a matter of fact, there are so many of these documents. But what is missing, even from a point of having been a public servant in the past, you get these many policies per day. It depends on who is in the leadership. If Mugonyapi comes in, then you're going to get 11 circulars in the morning and 13 in the afternoon. And the 13 that come in the afternoon contradict those that came in the morning. And nobody ever checks it whether those things are implemented or not implemented. And that is the problem. How are you going to ensure? And how are you going to ensure accountability? How are you going to ensure that these things are implemented to the letter? And I'm asking this question, Honorable Ngwenya, because I'm sitting here with sector policing strategy that I don't know whether it has been implemented. Anybody is making a follow-up on that. What will be different this time? I'm just asking, that is the question. But also going to ISS, or in fact, CASAT, I really want to know, can we combat corruption? I just want to know, what are the international trends possible? Are we trying to get something achievable or not achievable? What is it that we can achieve? What are the international trends? Somebody was actually, I think I was reading another document to say, even in countries where it has been reduced, it will go over a period of time and it goes up again. It will depend on financial muscles of countries and so on, poverty and so on, employment and so on. Is it achievable? I'm just asking. But what is it that as a country we can realistically achieve so that we can actually say we fought corruption? I think the question was asked by quite a number of members to say, what definitely will be the similarities and differences between what you suggest and the agency is suggesting and the scorpion that we hear? I think that question has been asked. But also, I just want to know, ISF, what is the extent of corruption in the private security industry? If probably you could tell us on this one. Because I think nobody talks about this industry. And also it goes to the question that was asked by Honorable Member Annelies to say, we're talking about a person who is receiving the bribe, but a person who is paying the bribe will not say anything. And in this case, for me, it will go to the private sector vis-a-vis the public sector. Is corruption in the public sector more than in the private sector? Is it balancing? But who is being reported? Who is being investigated? And going to the newspaper today and even tomorrow, you're not going to get much said about corruption in the private sector. And is it probably a continuation of what used to happen during apartheid, that there was a lot of corruption, but it was protected, it was not exposed, it was covered? Is there a link between what is happening today in ensuring that corruption in the private sector remains a protected species, and what was happening during apartheid, and only we talk about corruption here? You're talking about this fracking, for instance, which in the main will not be from government, it will be somebody from private sector, and it will be just like something that is okay. And it is the private sector sometimes that is paying this huge grant to these officials. And they, when they then do not give them a tender, then of course it becomes a matter, then they go to media, it is reported, and nobody is going to take up the fact that, but initially, this person was corrupt and was paying bribes, was paying these huge sums of money. They are now fighting because it's not been given a huge a tender. How? What is the extent of corruption there? I want to know from the two
representative, what are your views on the sub-presentation? In fact, the ACS sub that has just presented, what are your views? Because I want to believe that probably you were talking. Kasak, you're talking about political insulation. What is that? Is it, can we really say we have, are you apolitical if I want to ask? Would I believe that you are, if I were to put you at the head of that agency, would I therefore think that you are apolitical? Are you apolitical? Are you clean? I'm just asking if that is the case. And sometimes when we talk about, you know, like we are here today, people believe that I'm a politician, therefore I'm corrupt. I'm not corrupt. I'm a saint. Clean, clear. I'm not corrupt. However, because I say I'm a politician, I'm viewed as this corrupt person. And because you are a civil society organization, it's taken, you are not corrupt. It's a perception that is out there to an extent that sometimes you want to begin by saying, I'm Cindy Chikunga, I'm a member of parliament, a politician, and I am not corrupt. You want to start by introducing yourself like that. And you don't have to. Because it's taken like you are a civil society organization, therefore. I'm not sure. I'm asking this question. Because when you talk about corruption, when you say it's like real, it's public and public. However, I want to know, ISM, what really, in your own view and from the research that you conducted, what is the extent of corruption? I mean, really, this time around, probably not even trying to protect anything. What is the real extent of corruption in fact? The real extent of corruption. I'm talking about the bribes. I'm talking about detectives that will investigate cases because it's relative, it's this and that. And this time around, when you are in Gauteng, you are told that people are released from prison to go and commit crime and given firearms that are in SAPS, and then they come back, and the detective who did that will then investigate that crime so that it does not go anywhere. And these are the things which I think we have got to say, so that people must know that we are now aware that these things are happening. You will never get this person, nor the firearm, because the firearm is in the section 13 stores, and the person who committed the crime is in the cells or whatever, and therefore you never investigate, and the person who is going to investigate the case is a person who is behind the whole crime, and it happens. And that is why you're going to hear somebody in Gauteng, who isn't a detective, is a detective, but a member who is said to have managed to buy a BMW 5004 cash and two quantum cash, and it takes the portfolio committee to say, but why are you not investigating them? Clean, clear. Why are you not investigating them? What is this? I mean, really, I can't afford that. I don't claim to be earning a better salary than that person. But I think none of us can afford such luxury for cash. And nobody seems to want to. I'm just asking, really, and that is why I'm worried, and I'm asking this question to say, in real terms and really, without trying to please anything and anybody, what do you think is the extent, the real extent of corruption in that? And is this strategy presented to us here, will ever begin to address problem, I mean, in real terms. Kasak?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you've summarized the kinds of issues that have been put to me, which is really about the nature of the agency that we're proposing, as well as the issue of political will. And I think the two certainly go hand in hand. If I could perhaps deal with one or two of the other questions first and then come back to that broader and bigger question afterwards. The relationship with other institutions and whether that will compromise the independence of the agency that we're proposing. The principle has to be that if the agency that is being proposed and is established, and if it is genuinely independent, own independence cannot be compromised by virtue of the fact that it has a relationship with other agencies. in such a way that it is not susceptible to being to its independence being compromised, even through relationships with other agencies. The question of whether when one creates such an agency, that one actually disbands other anti-corruption structures and incorporates them all under one umbrella, that's a policy decision that will need to be discussed and will need to be considered. I don't think that impacts really though on the issue of independence. It may impact on the issue of overlapping mandates, create some uncertainty and so on. I think that's an issue that will need to be considered in that context. On the question of the silence of the corruptor and the issue that you raised, Madam Chair, with regards to only looking at the recipient of the bribe rather than the payer of the bribe, I think it's trite to say that there are two sides to a corrupt act. It is a contract, it is a transaction between two people or two organizations or two sides. And there's a bribe payer and there's a bribe taker. And both sides are equally corrupt. Now, yes, it's probably true to say that the focus has been unduly on the recipient of the bribe, the public servant. Private business is equally guilty. As part of our strategy and campaign, as I said earlier, we have engaged, for example, with business structures, the Business Leadership South Africa, as well as the BUSA, to get them to acknowledge that corruption is an issue that the business community, the organized business community in South Africa, needs to take seriously. And it is something that they're willing to do so. And they've, in fact, started to incorporate issues of ethics within their own internal codes of conduct within BLSA. Again, the issue of the nature of corruption is also comes back to the issue of public education and creating an understanding about what constitutes corruption. And it's not just public servants, traffic officers who are guilty of corruption, but it is big business that pay bribes, that actively go out and seek weaknesses in the system. And that's one of the issues that we need to tackle is corruption thrives because of institutional weaknesses. We have robust independent structures, and accountable structures, the opportunities for corruption will be diminished. So I think it's really understanding the whole range of issues in that regard. The question about, you know, we've had the SAPS agency that's been spoken about is an internal focus on corruption within the police service as such. Now that plays an important role in my opinion. Also take this opportunity to answer your question, Madam Chair, what my perception of the SAPS presentation is. It's necessary because it's inward focusing. I think every structure of society, and particularly in the public sector, as well as I said, within business and with civil society, I'll deal with civil society a little bit later, we all have to take responsibility for rooting out corruption within our own spheres of influence. So insofar as this is a strategy and a proposal that is being engaged with regards to rooting out corruption within the police service, I think it's an important step, and it's particularly important because of the role that SAPS plays as a law enforcement agency, that it needs to be seen to be clean. The issue that I spoke about earlier about public confidence and public perception about institutions, and Gareth made the point that, you know, people do, you know, the police service is not a corrupt institution. There are elements of corruption within it, and we've got to shift that public perception so that the police are seen as independent. The role of the anti-corruption strategy and the agency that is being proposed helps to deal with that issue, then that is another building block in the fight against corruption. On the question of the national dialogue, I think there's two parts of it. What I was talking about was in two different ways. One, that we need a national dialogue now, and I'll talk about the reason of why now in relation to the Glenister judgment and so on. But the dialogue is necessary now in order to define the kind of model of an anti-corruption agency or agencies that we may wish to put in place, because that informed debate will help us to devise the correct strategy. And then also the longer-term issue in terms of the three-pronged strategy that I spoke about, or the three-pronged mandate of the independent agency, is that education will be a part of that responsibility on an ongoing basis. So public education and a national dialogue on an ongoing basis will be necessary. In relation to the question of what is meant by the sufficiency of evidence being the sole criterion for prosecution. It is to eliminate the issue of key discretion when it comes to the prosecution of acts of corruption. As I was trying to point out earlier, within the National Prosecution Policy Guidelines, the National Director of Public Prosecution has the discretion to not to pursue a particular matter, even if there is evidence, if it is in the public interest not to do so. And that discretion resides with the NDPP. Now, we are saying that in the context of corruption, that the National Director of Public Prosecution should not have that discretion, and that we must agree that it is always in the public interest to prosecute that act of corruption, and that there can be no circumstances in which it is not warranted. And that, again, seeks to consolidate the issue of independence and non-partisanship, and to insulate it again from political influence, so that political influence cannot play a role in the decision to prosecute. Because if you have an independent investigative agency, your prosecutorial service has got to be equally full of integrity in order that the whole process itself is not compromised. To come to the Glenister judgment, the judgment did not say that there had to be a new agency created. What the judgment, the case decided upon was that the hawks, as they are currently constituted, did not meet the constitutional criteria of independence for an anti-corruption agency. So the court said that the hawks, as they're currently structured, and it pointed out to the issue of the ministerial committee and a whole range of other factors to point to the shortcomings of why the hawks were not constitutionally compliant as an independent anti-corruption agency. So the court has not directed, and in fact, it very specifically did not say how the agency should be insulated from political influence. It just says that it should be influenced. It should be exempted from political influence, and it's in fact left it up to Parliament to define how that does. And it in fact it expressly says in the judgment that it is not their job to dictate to Parliament what to do. So that's why I'm saying that there's a window of opportunity now. So although Glenister has not said that we must create an independent, dedicated standalone agency, as the Council for the Involvement of the South African Constitution, we are saying this now provides us with a window of opportunity to really look at the most effective kind of mechanism that we can put in place in order to fight corruption. In that regard, there are two things I want to do. Firstly, I want to quote from the National Planning Commission's diagnostic report, and where they say this, and I quote, "The numerous anti-corruption agencies and laws and forums also present their own problems due to overlapping mandates and the lack of strategic coordination of investigation bodies." And that refers back to the list of agencies and multi-agency initiatives that I referred to earlier. So there's this whole plethora of institutions, but the Planning Commission itself knows that they're not being effective. So what we're saying is that this therefore provides the opportunity to rethink our whole approach. So rather than taking a narrow view of what the court in the Glenister case is saying in terms of creating areas of or structures of independence around the existing hall, let's take this opportunity to rethink our whole strategy on the matter. And that comes back to the second point in that regard, Madam Chair, which is your question about is it achievable? Can we make a dent in fighting corruption? I think this really does go hand in hand with the issue of political will. And what is it that we mean by the question of political will? At the end of the day, it is about being committed to creating an independent agency and not being afraid of the fact that an independent agency will act without fear, favor, or prejudice. And secondly, to ensuring that agency has sufficient resources and skilled personnel to be able to execute its mandate. If those two things are provided, the independence and the resources, then we can have an agency that is effective in fighting corruption. Again, I think we do agree that corruption is a major problem within South Africa. I think all the presentations have alluded to that today, so we cannot deny that. And in those countries in which the single model agency has been adopted, as the two examples I used earlier of Hong Kong and Botswana, Singapore is another one, they came to the decision to implement those agencies precisely because corruption was so rampant in those societies, precisely because it became almost second nature. And they did make a dent in fighting corruption in those societies through creating independent structures and, very importantly, ensuring that sufficient resources were deployed to allow those agencies to be successful. The fact that we're creating an independent agency does not mean that it's an agency that's not going to be accountable. And I dealt with the issue of how the agency could be accountable to Parliament, that it can be accountable even to the executive, but it cannot be accountable to the executive for operational matters. It can only be accountable to the executive insofar as overall guidelines and framework and the expenditure of public money. It cannot be accountable to the executive in any other way. And so we can, again, it's about creating the right sort of checks and balances within the to ensure that it is properly independent but also accountable. And those are two things that are not that can coexist quite happily side by side. We need to find the right balance between them. Are we apolitical? Certainly not. CAFEC is a political organization. It's a non-party political organization, but it's a very political organization. And many people say to us that as a new NGO, why is it that we've chosen the most difficult subject within the South African context of corruption? It is because it is fundamental to the realization of all the other rights in the Constitution. If we don't deal with the issue of corruption, we're never going to deal with the issue of the delivery of socioeconomic rights. So it's fundamental to us. Corruption doesn't only exist in the public sector, as I said. It exists within civil society. We see it in sports bodies in South Africa. We see it in NGOs. We see it in the churches. It is everywhere. And that's why I say it's got to be a comprehensive societal response. We all have responsibilities to tackle corruption wherever we are. And I think if we do that and we have this national conversation about how we each operate in our own silos, as it were, in our own areas of work to combat corruption, will make a contribution to the greater good, but we can also see the bigger picture. Because corruption, as has been said many times, is now a national priority of government, and it needs to be treated as such, and we need to give it the proper attention and come up with a solution that can actually, to answer your question, Madam Chair, make it achievable to fight corruption.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, the Pull Back campaign, we want to certainly tell people in communities that they mustn't be bribing police officials to pay money over for anything unless they get defeat in particular circumstances. But so it'll be part of the campaign that we really want to say this is what you can expect from police service. When you go to a police station, you know, maybe tell people what they can expect. So they don't think that, because if you find people pay money over to police officials, they're not sure that they can't. They've been told to find when they should not. And other police agencies have used a approach of monitoring the numbers of arrests made by police officials of corrupt. So that's something you might want to see as well. How often do police officials arrest somebody when they're trying to be bribed? Or arrest them for attempted corruption, at least. When it comes to the issue of perception surveys, I'm not quite sure I completely understand the question. The surveys I refer to are in the report. I have made copies available to the committee. But probably the most regular report is the Afrobarometer, which happens quite regularly. They're showing that 46, and it's fluctuated about 46, 48%, depending on the year, of respondents, yeah, national representative sample, believe that all or most police to be corrupt. So that means that the other 54% don't believe that, which is a good thing, but it's a very high proportion. And similarly, that 50%, 54% in 2008 at least, trust police at all, not at all. So it's quite a large proportion of the population that don't, and these are from surveys, not our own surveys, but the surveys from Apple Barometer. We refer to some other surveys as well, so the details are in that report. We haven't done research on the extent of corruption in the private sector, certainly the private security industry, so I can't talk much about it, but I have no doubt that it exists. Certainly from some of the work that I've done in the past, you do find that members of the private security companies that because of the information they have possessed about security weaknesses in warehouses or people's homes or businesses are run by criminal syndicates to get that information. It's not actually working hand in hand with the system. So it's likely to happen there as it happens everywhere else. I think the focus, I mean, particularly our work on police corruption, is that if you want to fight corruption almost anywhere else, you've got to start with the police, because if the police are corrupt, you can't fight corruption anywhere else. So we're not thinking that the police are more corrupt than anybody else, and in fact, we don't think the police are the most corrupt department necessarily, or have, we don't think the corrupt organization, I said before. And that's where I can't tell you what the proportion is. We don't know. If you look at this, the studies internationally for decades now, they just don't, there's no way they're actually finding out, because it's such a hidden crime. Because the two people involved in it, the corrupt or the corruptee, are usually both committing a crime, both are benefiting, and very rarely they're a third party. So sometimes it's only really possible to actually proactively tackle corruption through things like lifestyle audits, where you start saying, well, you know, if you get the salary, how do you manage to, if you're a police official, where you're getting early warning systems in place, where you get a large number of complaints about police taking bribes or doing certain things that are police station in a certain place, and you go in and you proactively set up a sting operation. Those are the most effective ways of tackling police corruption, simply because you can't wait for reports if it's very underreported. And if you look at the number of cases that we've just on the annual reports of people that have been disciplined or suspended for police corruption, it's about 0.05% of police personnel contingent. So that's about 300 to 400 people. I mean, if only 5% of the police service is corrupt, you're talking about quite a few thousand people. It's 195,000 people working inside the police service. But we don't know what it is. And certainly, I've been in police stations and worked with police managers at different stations where one will say to me, it's just a small handful, maybe only about 5% of the police station. And another manager at the same police station will say, I think it's between 60 and 70% are actually taking some kind of bribery at some point in time. So those are people working. So not even people working at police stations can actually tell you that. And sometimes it depends on their own attitudes, depends on what they think the problems are, where they're getting information from. I want to just say that I think that I was heartened by the South African Police Service presentation of the anti-corruption strategy. We have played some role in 2008-2009, I think it was, with trying to feed some information in and assisting them with it. But certainly it's come a long way. From what I saw today, it really covers pretty much everything you could possibly hope to have. And really some, I think looking at the issue of promoting professional services is very important, because we tend to see corruption is an outcome of a range of problems. And by the time you deal with corruption, you've actually really got a whole lot of problems, and you really got to have a more proactive approach that sort of rewards, promotes, facilitates, and encourages professional activity, because people who are not corrupt are just not corrupt. And that's the kind of thing you find. It's not an issue of salaries. You know, police officials all get certain salary ranks, and we come across constables and that who often bribe all the time and don't take them. It's just they believe in what they're doing. It's a calling for them to be a police officer to help their communities, and they just don't take bribes. And it's very heartening to see that. So those people really must be supported and encouraged, and they must become the role model. And they must be the image of a police a man or woman that South African public has. And that's where we've really got to tackle this issue in the police service very dramatically. And I think it can be, to answer your question, can we come at it? Yes, we can. We've looked at a few examples. You know, places like Hong Kong, they talk about, we're seen as sort of institutionally corrupt at one point, now seen as one of the cleanest law enforcement agencies. We've looked at New York City's police department, where in the 70s and again in the 90s, whole boroughs were corrupt. The entire police precinct was involved in actually running certain elements of the organized crime, and that no longer seems to be the case. It's never going to be an ongoing contested situation. I think it's you can never rest on your laurels. And it's just that as you be successful in some circumstances, you might find that new wave of corruption can occur. So anti-corruption strategy, it's good to see one of the trial programs have been implemented, but it's something that ultimately should be in the background, and that the emphasis should be that the strategy is to promote professional, honest men and women in the police service. The consequences of being that are going to be a rewarding, life-fulfilling job and service to your country and your communities. And the consequences of not doing that are going to be felt and clearly felt for those who break. And I think that's where we've got to actually shift. I think a lot of the negative perceptions from corruption that we saw in our focus groups doesn't always come from deliberate or direct experience. It's from experiences where they've heard of problems, where people that they've come across, or where they've heard of people being arrested, police officials and coming back on duty, or there's many cases not going through. So it's a range of complex factors that influence public perceptions, but I think it can.
Chair. I will try and answer a number of the questions, though in case there might be those that are left, my colleagues will answer. And where we do not have information, we will humbly request that we be allowed to forward the responses in writing at the later stage. We can be given timelines to that effect. Honorable Chair, in terms of the anti-corruption communication plan, when was it developed? It was identified as a priority during the beginning of this financial year. Subsequent to that, it was developed. I do have a hard copy which I'm willing to give to the honorable member. It has also an implementation plan that talks to the specific dates, reflecting what should happen and when. Maybe if I can talk to the first activity that talks to the pre-launch, it talks to September 2011, starting this month. It starts this month, and then we'll be continuing, including the launch, which will be on the 9th of November, and then we'll be proceeding. There is an implementation plan. And then the second question that talks to training for corruption, the module which has been included at training level, the current trainees that are at the college, those that are undergoing training for a period of 12 months basic training, they are amongst their modules, there is an area that deals with corruption specifically. The detection pillar, when will it happen? We indicated that we will be finalizing the anti-corruption strategy. Immediately after finalization, it will be presented at the management forum, which will be in this coming management forum, September. It's scheduled the 24th, if I'm not mistaken. There will be a presentation. We currently busy with the population. We also indicated that we gave provinces and other offices till the 16th of September for them to forward input, which will be populated also in the strategy. And then after the approval by the National Management Forum, there will be an implementation plan, which will be specific to say this should happen on this date. The outcome of cases, the breakdown of the 479 cases, whether how many were dismissed and arrested, we'll humbly request, Honorable Chair, if we could be allowed to forward information at a later stage. The anti-corruption unit, I do not have an answer as to why the previous anti-corruption units were disbanded. However, what I'm able to say is we have realized that there is a need. Hence, we have sanctioned a work study investigation. We will be giving them 3 months, which the 3 months commences September, from September. Why 3 months is because for a work study investigation, we will need them to consult thoroughly to ensure that we consult. For instance, today I also learned that there is a lot that we can get from the IFS and the other body. I will then request organizational development, being people that are conducting work study investigations, to consult with them as part of the investigation that will inform how many members should be placed under the anti-corruption unit, and obviously also talk to the financial implications thereof. The disciplinary process that takes too long. Honorable Chair, discipline, the management of discipline within the SAPS remains a national priority. I think it has been a national priority for the past 3 years. We haven't taken it out as a priority by reason that we are also not yet satisfied on the management. What we did, we set time frames for finalization of cases. For instance, we are saying a disciplinary case will be finalized within 60 days, and where there is a suspension within 90 days, but then it also provides for an extended period where, because some of the cases we have been encountering a difficulty where we get challenged by lawyers, unions getting, that is labor, finding ways of deliberately delaying the process. It's safe to say we are also engaging revisiting the current disciplinary code, because we also realize that there are gaps that allow for the delays. Also, Honorable Chair, I must say, with the time frames that are set and also included in the performance agreement of the managers, there is an improvement. Yes, of course, we're not yet there. The corruption focus seems to be lying with middle management. We take note of that and will ensure that we strengthen towards ensuring that it's at all levels. In the presentation, we also indicated that there will be a development of training that will be talking to all levels. I think in our implementation plan, it will be necessary then taking into consideration what was raised to ensure that we specifically talk to targeting senior management. I'll request the General Mazibuko later to talk to the promotions, which talk to the career pathing of the detectives. I know for the fact that also the coming management forum, we scheduled a work session that will be focusing on detectives only, because we have realized that there are challenges in some of the things that will be dealt with, but it will be able to talk to them. The role of the IPIC, Honorable Chair, having discovered that we do have challenges, many a times we found ourselves in a situation where we would have seemed not to be complied with the recommendations from the ICD, if I can also refer to them. What we did now, we ensured that there is a forum where we're able to engage. For instance, prior to my current responsibilities, I was responsible for discipline management. At no time did I ever see any of the recommendations forwarded, but I will find myself in a situation where I will have to answer for the recommendations which were forwarded from the ICD and were not attended to. We recently debated, also emanating from the session that was held dealing with the Domestic Violence Act, we debated as a management forum. We agreed on writing a letter that goes to the executive director to say let us open a relationship, direct working relationship, including the forum that has already been established where the SAPS sits with the members from the ICD and members of the secretariat, focusing on the role as given to the ICD. How many cases are sourced that talk to the current cases? May we also request the Honorable Chair that we be given an opportunity to respond to this in writing, that breakdown of the cases that are sourced. One of the questions talked to, we are saying we... But it talks to sensitization and identifying corruption as a risk area. It was indicated that we seem to be indicating about things that we'll be doing. The presentation was talking to what we emphasize doing, which will be in line with the strategy that we're working on. But then it also talks to what is it that we are doing currently, including the identification of corruption as a risk, which was listed in the risk register and is being dealt with by the Risk Management Committee. And then the continuous sensitization, which included the circular that was forwarded. And I think there were other activities. As we proceeded with the presentation, it continuously reflected what is the current implementation within the organization and what is it that we'll be doing. The intended implementation of the lifestyle audit.
If we look at that presentation, it talks to the intended, what we intend implementing in the strategy. In our implementation plan, we have to be specific in terms of what is it that we will be doing and what are the time frames and who will be responsible for what. The strat plan, the finalization, as raised by Reverend Mishra, the anti-corruption strategy, we indicated that it will be finalized during a presentation at the management forum. The framework was approved at the management forum, hence it's important for us to go back to say, we have now populated the strategy, it's finalized, and then it gets approved. Wiping of corruption at all levels, I've spoken to that, and also if I were to share, Honorable Chair, I think it's 3 weeks that in Nelspruit I know that a senior member was also arrested for corruption, fraudulent, submitting of fraudulent claims. When these cases get reported, there is no exception as to who has committed crime. Where there is a complainant and it gets reported, an investigation will be initiated. There could be, one must acknowledge that here and there we might be having challenges. Hence we are, with this current strategy that we're working on, we'll be trying to strengthen our own systems to ensure that we talk to them. The recruitment process, the involvement of the community during the recruitment process, that process already started. The current trainees that are at the college went through that process. General Mazbuko, also as the custodian of recruitment, will be able to talk to the how part of it. The shortage of vehicles. Honorable Chair, I wouldn't say there is a shortage of vehicles. I think the current situation is that managers get given an opportunity to identify their needs, and then they get allocated resources in line with their needs. What could be problematic is maybe the utilization after they have identified those needs. And at times it talks to the issue of command and control, which we have identified as a challenge within the SAPS, and it is a priority for this financial year. We hope to improve. On the case that was raised by the Honorable MP, I will personally engage so that I can get the details to make a follow-up on what could have happened to that specific case. We also identified the issue of abuse of these vehicles. That also leads to a high raise in the civil claims. From the legal department, it is also a focus area, the issue of abusing vehicles where they just get bumped and all those things. Inclusion of the ISS, we take note of that, and fortunately, during break, I also spoke to Gareth to say we need to have a session. I indicated that we need to engage, and he indicated that he would want to present to us. And then, obviously, what will be presented to us will be considered also as part of populating the strategy. We will try and arrange so that it can be done very soon prior to going to the management forum. What will we be doing better on the lack of accountability, Honorable Chair? How are we going to ensure that it is done? Chair, one emphasis is that as part of the implementation plan, which will be specific on what is expected of who and when, that will also partly address that. But other than that, I think in the next financial year, we will have to make it a point that this the strategy, the anti-corruption strategy.
gets its way into the performance agreement and the performance enhancement processes of the members. I think that is the only way that we can be able to hold people accountable for omission in case they are not implementing. We will ensure that it gets included in the performance agreement and the PEP document. We take note of the concern about the lack of accountability, and many a time policies get drafted and then there is no implementation. We take note of that, and we do our best as we go back to relook at that. The perception about police being corrupt is there. We are aware. Hence, in our communication strategy, we are also indicating that another focus will be having a communication officers dealing with the issue of perceptions, focusing on the external environment. Safe to say, negative publicity by our media in South Africa also perpetuates that. We will be trying to deal with that. And of course, I think in other instances, though I do not have a percentage, some are informed by the reality that is there. I did speak to Command Better Training for Managers, which talks to Command and Control, which we hope will improve in the. Okay. Thanks, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, we regard this session also as an empowering session, which will be. What transpired here will be taken into consideration as we go back to finalize our anti-corruption strategy, including further collaboration with the bodies that are here, the ISS and the other bodies, I think.
National Inspectorate question.
Sorry, I'm repeating the question. The National Inspectors plays a pivotal role in the policy that as you've tabled it. Yet we found at stations that the inspectors are ignored. Inspectors would come to us, would come to a station 3 months before the committee arrived at the station. They would have findings. The committee will come and will find exactly those same things wrong. How are you going to strengthen the inspectorate? How are you going to make sure that SAPs actually take the inspectors seriously? Because currently I don't believe they are.
Honorable Chair, we do take note. In our slide number 11, the detection pillar, we have indicated that we will develop an integrated approach to detecting corruption within the staff. And the under objective two, we indicated that we will ensure an integrated detection approach by crime intelligence, the inspectorate. That's how we are going to ensure that the they are being taken seriously. We do take note of the concern raised by the Honourable Member about the fact that the inspectorate is not taken seriously. In our strategy, we indicated that they will be on board, but I think it's not only that. We do take note of the concerns the Honourable Member is raising. Thanks.
No, thank you very, very much. We have run out of time. Yes, General, the inspectorate, if you read their reports, they are very detailed. And they say one and the same thing over and over again. However, we have also visited 4 provinces. And after visiting each province, we write and compile a detailed report. In provinces, we visited police stations, but also here in the Western Cape, we have visited Philippi Academy and Bishop Lavis Academy. If you read those reports, they say one and the same thing. We visited Western Cape, KZN, Mpumalanga, and Gauteng. If you read this report, they say one and the same thing. And it is only when we visited the police station that something is going to happen. But you wonder whether in the police station that you did not visit, anything is going to happen. And we will request that as you meet as the management forum, you probably look into these reports. You should. Because they are tabled before parliament and they are adopted by parliament. And it's therefore expected that the department will implement the recommendations, if not they must be able to say to us, we couldn't because of these reasons. But let me just say that we have indeed been to these provinces and they are reports, detailed reports. So it's not just only the as we close, can I just really say thank you very much for the presentation. I think, as one of the presenters said, I think the Kazakh said, it should not be the last time that we talk about a topic of this nature. I fully agree. We must talk about this. For me, I think corruption is indeed a disease that is eating the moral fiber of our existence. It makes people to think like hardened criminals, to think like, out of this money, how much must I get? Out of this budget, what will be my share? In order to get that share, what must I do, even if it is wrong? In order to make this person to sign an illegal contract, what must I pay him, including maybe paying for a holiday flight to a posh resort so that I can get that contract? If you just look into this is the thinking of criminals, that I will want to get into that house and get the TV and I will kill whoever that stands in front of me, or I will get in there, I will study and so on. And I think this is therefore a real disease which we need to cure, to find a cure and deal with it once and for all. I also agree, as I said, that we need not to keep quiet about this. And probably it should be dealt with us in this chamber. And the question which we need to answer to ourselves and our consciences is whether I am or you are corrupt. Are you corrupt? Am I corrupt? Or am I hiding somebody who I know is corrupt, but because that somebody is my colleague, is my friend, is a family member, or is somebody, you know, I respect, then I will not talk about that. That as well is equally a crime, it's a criminal act. Government has prioritized corruption fighting, and personally I really believe that all corruption must be exposed. I think it is time that we are not soft on any corruption as a country. Whether it is in the public sector or it is in the private sector, I think let's just go out, rather be hated, but let us expose corruption. And in this regard, I'm also referring to our media. Let's expose corruption. And that is all. I mean, this is the only way maybe we're going to have it correct. Because as long as other people think that they will never be exposed, then corruption is going to continue. I would also agree with you that says we need to strengthen our systems. And in this regard, I just want to say, probably the review of the white paper, as well as the sub-act, will give us an opportunity to ensure that we strengthen the systems that probably might be allowing some of these things to happen, in this case within SARS. But however, also I think it is important to mention that quite a number of sub-members have been arrested and dismissed, particularly in provinces such as Gauteng and Mpumalanga, in the border post areas of Mpumalanga. And these were arrested by SARS and dismissed by SARS. So it's not just gloomy. Something is indeed happening. However, I think we should do much better. And I think we have the capacity to do better. I just want to thank you all for the presentations and for this discussion. We will be interested to hear more on anything that you have done. If we have time to accommodate you on our program, we'll always do that. I thank you very much. And